Call this meeting, joint meeting of the Houghton Community Council and the Planning Commission to order. Could we have roll call, please?
Brian Gothrop?
Here.
Bill Goggins? John Kepler? Betsy Pringle?
Here.
Elsie Weber?
Here.
Rick Whitney?
Here.
Kelly Curtis? And now Planning Commission, Carter Bagg? Colleen Cullen?
Here.
Eric Laliberti?
Here.
Mike Miller?
Present.
Glenn Peterson?
Here.
Sandeep Singhal?
Here.
Matthew Pruitt?
Here.
Okay, for tonight, for this joint meeting, we will have public hearings on the Chapter 90 deliberation, the 2016 Comp Plan Amendment to Capital Facilities Element, and the Zoning Code Amendments Low Impact Development, followed by some administrative reports. There is, before that, an opportunity for comments from the audience that are on topics other than the public hearings. And before that, the Planning Commission will be reading and approving their minutes from the last three meetings. I am going to turn over the meeting at this point to Eric Laliberti to proceed with their approval of the minutes and have Eric conduct the public hearing portion of this meeting. And after that, there will be a, after we complete this joint meeting, there will be a Houghton Community Council meeting after a brief break. And so with that, I am turning the meeting over to Eric.
Okay, we have three sets of meeting minutes to approve: July 28, 2016, August 11, 2016, and August 25, 2016. All three were provided to us in advance of the meeting. Anyone have any changes, or is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve.
Okay.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. All those in favor of the motion to approve the July 28, August 11, and August 25, 2016 minutes, say aye.
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 Aye. Okay, approved unanimously. Mr. Whitney, were you inviting me to handle the comments from the audience as well this evening?
Yes, go ahead, Eric.
Thank you. Do we have anyone sign in for general comments tonight? Okay. And it looks like everyone who was here for the workshop has left. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to give comment tonight that did not have the opportunity to sign up? Okay. In that case, we will move on to the public hearing of the Chapter 90 Zoning Code. And we've already held the oral part of the public hearing, and that has been closed. We accepted additional written materials up until our meeting tonight, and I understand we did receive several of those, which were provided by email, and I think we have some with us tonight, and they're in our packet. So I suppose we now will move on to deliberation for this item. Mr. Whitney, I will allow you to lead us in the deliberation.
Well, first,
I think Teresa
has staff
presentation.
Yeah, there's staff responses to some of the written comments. We have some potential changes we want to put forth as well.
Mr. Stewart.
Are we trying to get the PowerPoint up?
Yeah, I am. Good evening. First, we'll start with the staff presentation, and then we'll go to questions and discussion by the Planning Commission, and then Houghton Community Council deliberation. and makes a recommendation to the Planning Commission, and then the Planning Commission delivers and makes a recommendation to City Council. Staff presentation will go over all the comments from the Planning Commission and Houghton Community Council, also from Brent Carson, who submitted oral comments and written comments, and then also some changes that staff is recommending since the memo that you received, and then you have those written, and we'll go through those slowly. And then in addition, we have a comment letter from Greg Reardon. And then lastly, there was a letter most recently from the Tyler Litzenberg, and we'll go over his comments. The first one is an issue both commissioners raised. It has to do with the effective date. Right now, staff is recommending March 1st, which is 77 days after adoption. Keep in mind that applicants have had 14 months. People receive written notice, and then we also send an email out to all the developers. So they've had plenty of opportunity to get applications in and ask questions. The state deadline was June 30th, but keep in mind the state gave an additional 12 months for an extension to June 30th. So that's basically a year behind June 30th is when we were supposed to have it done. We also have state grants that are pending on completion of the Chapter 90. We have Public Works. It's flickering, isn't it? Public Works applied for grants, and one thing is they have to check off that our Chapter 90 is current. So right now they show pending, so if we wait later, it's going to be further out of compliance, and the issue is the state grants.
Teresa, quick question on that. It says that it's contingent upon adoption, but does the adoption, if we adopt Chapter 90 and make the effective date later,
well, then we're not.
Is the grant subject to the effective date or the adoption date?
I don't think the state thinks in terms of those two different dates. They probably assume most people have it go in effect. Sometimes we will push out the date, but I think we need to try to keep it reasonably close to our effective date. I think they probably assume our effective date is our adoption date.
I would add, typically, it would be the effective date that they would look at in terms of whether we're eligible for grants or not. That's how they, if it's not in effect, it's not really been eligible, perhaps, for certain types of funding sources.
Are you speculating or are you certain on that?
I'm probably 80% certain on that.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Lisa, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why does the screen go black and then on and black and then on?
Yeah,
is there
our screens
a problem?
Are flashing in and out.
I have no idea.
Can you turn the lights
down so we can see the presentation up there better on top?
A little hard on the eyes.
Or dim them?
We need to remodel this chamber.
That's not nice.
They've had technical problems in here, and this is probably. And your screens are flickering?
Right now they're black.
They go completely black. And
wow.
And then they come back on, and my eyeball gets adjusted, and it goes out again.
It's like better to not have them.
I must have a seizure.
Yeah. Maybe we could reboot and see if that will fix anything. But.
Starting with the Planning Commission, Mr. Miller gave us some edits and comments, and we went ahead and incorporated those in. For improved wording on restoration of critical areas and also about the ratio for mitigation. We would recommend the Planning Commission have further discussion on reasonable use, because we have one commissioner that thought the 5 years was reasonable, and we have one commissioner thinks it's 2 years for a reasonable use exception. That's how long they have to apply for a building permit. So the question is, right now it's only 1 year. 5 years is what other zoning permits have. So later on, after we finish the meeting, we'd like you to kind of discuss that and give staff a final direction. From Hope Community Council, first was a comment about addressing private property rights, and that is now in the purpose section, so we've added that. There was an issue raised about exemption for repair, maintenance, and installation of private utilities, and we've added that. So those and private utilities where it runs from the right-of-way to someone's property. It's installed by a provider, but it's on their property. So now those are also exempted, those repairs.
Quick question on that, Teresa. Is it all right if we ask a clarifying question?
Certainly,
when,
if that works best. Let's
yeah, look. I just think whether it would help for me if you've made a representation that you've corrected something and then I'm questioning. On that specific thing on the private utilities?
Yes.
It appears to me, the way that it reads, that it's only if they are within existing legally improved private roadways. Isn't it possible that there could be private utilities that are not within roadways?
Joan's yes. Going to respond.
Yes, that is correct, but this exemption is only for repair, maintenance, or installation within the existing rights-of-way, private roadways, utility corridors, or the Cross Kirkland Corridor, or the East Side Rail Corridor. However, under permitted activities, new public utilities, sewer and water may
Can
be
we turn it off?
Proposed anywhere yeah. within the buffer.
That's right.
If they're requiring gravity. So there has to be a reason for the new utility to be installed other than in existing corridors, the way it's written now. So if you look to the permitted activity section, there's a subsection on utilities, new utilities, you'll
right.
notice.
Yeah.
And all utilities can be in the outer quarter, 25% of the buffer. That's per state, best available science, and so on. But if you have sewer or stormwater, sewer or stormwater that requires gravity, then you can go further into the buffer to connect to whatever private or public use would be.
I understand, but you're talking about new.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about repairing, maintaining, or replacing existing
yes.
utilities.
Yes, and they always are in it. Some kind of either a utility corridor or an easement.
Understood, but what mm-hmm. if on a private, if you're talking about the private utilities,
right.
what if they aren't located within a roadway, but they're existing, and you're trying to maintain them, repair or maintain them? That's not covered the way this is worded.
Yeah. That would be considered in the utility corridor, in the easement. So it could be on private property. It's not in a roadway. It's in a utility corridor. So if it veers off of the roadway, but it's in an existing utility easement, that's a utility corridor. It would be a recorded utility corridor, right? Easement on the subject property.
If you look at Section 90.35, it kind of lists those exemptions. It talks about repair and maintenance of structure, public streets, and utilities. So it's covered under that section, whether it's,
I just want to make sure that there wouldn't be a situation where a private utility is not within a roadway, and maybe there's not an easement recorded for it, and that's. It seems to me that this might be construed that it's only within a recorded easement and/or existing private roadway. All I'm trying to do is make sure that we are making sure that any existing private utility can be maintained without, and it is considered an exempt activity. Is this fully covering all that? And I guess, Mike, you're more of a more knowledgeable about this stuff than I am. But do you feel like this, the way it's worded, it protects landowners?
I guess my concern would be the definition of improved utility corridors.
Yeah.
You guys are suggesting that would cover somebody's sewer line running through their front yard or backyard, whatever. But that happens to be within a buffer. Is that an improved utility corridor?
Yes, because there is typically an easement if it was legally.
Yeah, to me, an improved utility corridor, what I would think of would be the, the Northwest Pipeline, gas mm-hmm. pipeline, a power line where they've cleared out an area, they've got a road, potentially have a road or some access road down that. That's an improved utility corridor. A sewer line to somebody's house through their front yard is not an improved utility corridor.
Would it be helpful to clarify that it said improved easement?
Well, but there wouldn't necessarily be an easement, though, because once a private property owner connects to a sewer line, that sewer line from the city's main to the house is on private property. There is no easement for it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's exactly my concern.
Okay. So we'll figure that out and clarify it in the regulation, because it was supposed to be for that type of a situation.
I thought that was your intent, but I don't think that this really meets it the way it's. If you could easily interpret this to not include that situation, and that's what I want to avoid.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry for the interruption, but I thought it was best to address it as we go along. Thank you.
The next one is just clarifying what is meant by degraded or what would be considered when you're looking at a degraded wetland. And note that most of our wetlands are already degraded because the urban environment, you already have sediment and situations that need restoration. So basically, it would look at vegetation, habitat, water quality, and the hydraulic functions, and it'd be on a case-by-case basis. And it would be part of the critical area report to determine if indeed the wetland needs to be restored or stream. But in most cases, it will be a wetland. One change that staff did not make had to do with the foundation and whether or not someone should be able to, if they tear down their house or if they have a casualty and they decide they want to replace the foundation. Staff still recommending that they move the foundation if it's possible, given yard setback, topography, existing conditions, to move the foundation out of the buffer. It may be only partially moved, but this is really a significant action when you replace a foundation. And keep in mind that the current approach, you cannot, if the house is damaged more than 50%, the entire house has to be moved out of the buffer and brought into conformance. So what we have now is much more lenient than what's under the current code. One of the community council members, yes?
If there's a casualty dam or the house is completely destroyed, they have to replace the foundation, and there's no other place on the property that you can put it and get out of the buffer.
Then it would stay. So it's only if there's.
But that wouldn't require. Would that require a reasonable use exception then, or exemption?
No, they would just be able to replace the foundation. So it's only, again, there's limitations on being able to move it. Some people may be able to. Some can just replace it under the casualty.
Okay. Mike, to follow up on your question there, I'm wondering if there might be situations where having to relocate the foundation could add significant economic impact to the property owner that isn't given any consideration when they're looking at what is possible ecologically. You track with that? And you as a developer, I think, would have a better perspective on that. My worry is there's no economic considerations in the determination of what is possible. And when somebody's already had a complete loss of their house, it's bad enough that they've lost their house, and then to add to it by saying, okay, but you're not only not going to be able to rebuild, but it's going to cost you a lot more money than if you just rebuild it where it was. Any thoughts?
So do you want Mike or do you want staff to respond?
Both. That's my concern. I want to give consideration. I try to put myself in the position of that person. If I was in their position, I would sure like to think that we're giving them every possible consideration when they've already lost their structure.
Well, economic concerns as part of overall 90 is not taken into consideration, and how does one measure that?
Yeah.
Again, if topography, it's very steep and it's not easy, and topography is one of the things listed, then they would not, if that's a challenge or they cannot do it, then they would not have to move it.
Well, and therein lies the question. If it's whether they could do it, but it's going to increase their cost dramatically, then that's where my concern lies. It's possible, but it's only possible at an extreme additional cost to somebody who's already suffered the loss of their structure.
To follow up on that, the letter that we got from Lutzberger, I believe it was, raised kind of an interesting question. I'm not going to delve into his just now, but following up on what Rick was asking, if somebody had a 5,000 square foot house, just for grins, say a 2,500 square foot footprint, and 3/4 of their lot was encumbered by a buffer, the house is completely destroyed, they have a 30-foot swath between the front yard setback and the wetland buffer and the building setback, which would restrict them from rebuilding a 5,000 square foot house, 2,500 square foot footprint, down to maybe 1,000 square foot footprint. How would the city deal with a situation like that, where you're cutting the size of their house in half?
Again, they can rebuild the structure. We're just asking to look to see if they can relocate it away from the buffer.
But they can relocate it away from the buffer or outside of the buffer, but it would reduce their house footprint.
They would still have part of the house in the buffer. So it's just moving it away to the maximum that they can. So they may still have half the house in the buffer and half the house outside of the buffer. It doesn't say they have to pull it totally out. It's just to move it so that it can be as much as it can be out of the buffer.
So the city's interpretation then would be they could rebuild a same size house.
Correct.
Even if the half of that new house would be within the buffer.
Correct, but at least it's a little bit further away from the buffer.
Are there going to be any footnotes or anything on this to clarify that?
If it's not clear, we'll go back in and clarify after this with the intent was just to move it. We'll look at the language again to make sure that's what it's saying. But yeah, that's the intent, is they get to build a house, but if they can shift it 10 feet away from the buffer, have them do that. They still get to rebuild the same size of the house.
Right. My concern on this one would be, if I look at paragraph 2, it talks about rebuilding to the greatest extent possible, but it doesn't specifically say, you know, like for like. So to Mike's point, the greatest extent possible would be a smaller house to avoid the buffer entirely.
Okay.
And so but if you say like for like, then you get the interpretation that you just described.
Okay. That's why it's good to have as many eyes on this, so that we think it says one thing, but you think it needs to be clarified. Yeah. That's what we will do. Anything else on the foundation? Okay, moving on. We had one Houghton Community Council member want us to clarify that for those non-conformances, where you can add 250 on the house toward the buffer, 1,000 square feet on the opposite side of the buffer between the house or 500, that they can do all three options. Yes, they can. They can only do one of each, but they can do all three, and we have now stated that in the code. One Houghton Community Council member was concerned about making sure that the waiver, if there is a daylighted or meandered stream and the buffers on the adjacent properties, would be wider because of shifting the location or daylighting, that there would be something recorded on the property. So we changed the language slightly, but we still would have to have the property owner's permission to record on their title. But again, so here we'll have the applicant contact them and give us a copy of that contact so we make sure that the property owner agrees to it before we record it.
Is that the word enters the property or meanders?
Do you want me to answer that question?
Sir, we generally don't have a discussion during the meeting. If you have questions, feel free to send an email to staff after the meeting. We're just trying to move it along. Thank you.
Before we leave that, though, I was the one to raise that issue. And Teresa, help me understand, under what circumstances would a property owner not want, it can only benefit them.
Correct, but we just have to make sure they agree to have something recorded on their property and not just go and record something on their property. So make sure we just have their permission to record something.
And why have this done through the applicant? Why not have the city have a standard notification that goes to the property owner that explains to them what's happening, what the impact to them could be, and how they benefit from it, and they simply need to, we simply want their consent to recording this to help protect them. Why not just have a standard procedure the city does rather than lay it in the applicant, which could be miscommunicated, misconstrued, whatever?
We'll provide them with a sample waiver form, but we want to put the burden and the work on the property owner because they're the ones that are requesting the meandering. So let them notify the property owners, but we'll give them a standard waiver because they're the applicants. We do this with appeals. If someone appeals, it's the appellant's responsibility to notify affected properties and not the city.
Right, so you will have standard notice, and you'll provide everything, but you're just asking the applicant to do it, and then you'll verify that they did it.
That's
according
the main
to
thing
your
is we'll verify and give them a probably come up with a standard waiver form. We don't get these very often. You know, daylighting streams are probably rare.
I understand.
Meandering, I think we've had just a couple situations, so these are going to be very unique. But we'll, if we have that situation, then we'll prepare the waiver forms, and they can send it to the applicant, and we'll give them guidance on what needs to be in the letter. In fact, we'll have them give us a copy of the letter so we know what's going out.
I would rather have the city have a standard notice that goes out on file, and it's just there prepared in advance. It's not something you rely upon the applicant to prepare.
Okay.
It's not, that shouldn't be that hard to do.
No promises. Well, hers is the only screen that's not doing it, in case you're wondering why she's perfectly happy.
That's a good thing.
Everybody has handouts too, right, of the PowerPoint?
Do we have extras for those in the audience? Maybe we could.
No, I don't have extra copies of this.
Jettison this.
Oh, I didn't have a choice. He's our tech expert here. How about you, Brian? Can you bring some? Come on.
I turned mine off.
Good solution.
Do
you want it off?
Well, we can turn our screens off, but it would be nice to be able to track with what she's doing.
I'll make three copies for the audience.
Okay.
Well, even her screen's not working right, so I'm not turning mine back on.
Okay, shall we go on to the next screen? The flickering screen? Okay.
Yeah.
This has to do with Brent Carson, and his comment was to provide private development with the same allowance as the public sector.
Quick question before we move on. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You said something that actually confused me. You said that a waiver would only be recorded if the property owner affirmatively accepted that the recording would be done on their property. Is that correct?
Correct, because the city doesn't like recording things onto someone's property unless they agree to have something recorded on their title.
So the text of the ordinance actually says that something will not be recorded if they object, which is sort of stating the opposite default.
Okay.
So my suggestion
we'll go
would
ahead
be
and change that
to,
more in the positive.
Yeah. Thank you.
Teresa, can I ask a question?
Yes.
What happens if the applicant is negligent and just throws the notice or whatever in his file cabinet and he never notifies those people? Is there some way the city's going to be able to notify those people to see if they've been contacted after a certain period of time?
Well, we may do what they have. We haven't come up with the administrative process for appeals. They have to sign an affidavit saying that they notified the properties. If you think this is a big issue, we'll just go ahead and notify them. It's going to be so rare we have something like this that if that's the direction you want us to take, that maybe is just the direction we can do.
Okay.
Personally, I would rather see that, Teresa, okay. Only to protect the rights of the neighbors. I just think that's it's like you say, it happens so infrequently that it's really not going to be that much of a burden to the city, and yet it does assure the protection of the neighbors.
Right. Okay, so we'll do that. We'll change it. Should we move on to the next screen, or do you have more?
Teresa, this might be a good time to my question with regards to that letter from Litzberger. You know, he showed that drawing of his property and the house being substantially within, or in fact, the whole lot being substantially within the proposed buffers. I was just kind of running through some scenarios in my own mind about how this ordinance might apply to somebody like him who would want to completely rebuild their house. In his scenario, could a person tear down the house down to the foundation?
I'll go to the very last, one of the last ones, because we were going to go through his property in detail.
Okay, here, well, if you want to do that, then go ahead and...
No, we have it up here, so here you are. So right now, he has a 75-foot buffer. So if you look at the flickering screen, his buffer takes up about half of his property currently. And if you look real closely at the screen, it's the red line. So he already has half of his house in the buffer. If under the current code, he can reduce it by one-third if that's approved. So that takes up just a corner of his property. Under the existing code, he's grandfathered in. He can do maintenance and repair. He cannot replace the structure, and he cannot add a second floor under the current code. He cannot expand the structure. He doesn't get any setback modification under the new code. You can reduce the setbacks. And if he had more than 50% damage on the house under the current code, he cannot rebuild. Under the new code, again, he can do, he's grandfathered in. He can do maintenance and repair. He can reconstruct the house as it is. He can add a second floor. He can expand on the size of his house. He couldn't do it toward the buffer because he has to have a buffer under the new code of at least 60%, which would be a 60-foot buffer. Again, right now he is required to have a 70-foot buffer. So he could expand on the sides of the house. He can reduce his front yard and his side yard, so he could shift the house toward the street and also on the side yards. And if he has a fire, he can totally replace the structure. So those are the distinctions. So keep in mind right now his house is already half in the buffer. So that's a summary.
We talk about fire loss, but can somebody take the house down? I mean, if they wanted to come into the city and do a quote-unquote remodel,
right,
take the house down to the foundation, then rebuild it on the foundation?
They can do that. That's under that. There's a section there under replacement. Okay. So someone, as long as it's in the same footprint, again, they could probably still do some different modulations as long as it doesn't encroach into the buffer. So he has a lot of opportunity under the new code of different things he could do.
And so basically,
his house is already quite constrained.
Right, but he brought up for me an interesting scenario. So my question is, somebody could come in a situation similar to his and take the house down.
Correct.
He doesn't have to burn it down. He can just take it down.
Correct.
Down to the foundation, rebuild on the foundation. In that scenario, you could go out to the sides, you can go out to the front, you just can't go any closer to the wetland itself.
Correct.
Okay.
And in fact, I think he has some flexibility going closer to the front because we're allowing for the setbacks to be reduced too.
So,
And I think we want to maybe contact him and maybe sit down and try to explain these options with him so he has a better understanding of how this might work in his situation.
And or hurry up and get a permit in. Of course, under the existing code, you can't do it.
Yeah, there you go.
He's got more flexibility under the new code.
You can. Right now, that one-third buffer, if he wants to have the house in the exact location, it just takes off a little corner of it. But he has to vegetate the buffer, which you would have to do now anyway under the future code. So he may not have been aware of all these different options.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Is there any more questions on that one? Because that we would have this. Okay, let's go back and see where we are here. Okay, so back to Brent Carson and his comments about allowing private development, the same as public sector. He raised the issue of exceptions, so that'd be reasonable use exceptions versus what the public agency can have. Reasonable use are what private sector can do. Public sector cannot do those, and under public agency exception, those are ones that the public agency can do. It gives them the opportunity to vary, just like a reasonable use, and those are not applicable for private sector. So they both have those different exception options, plus they can apply for the wetland and stream modifications. There was no need to change on the private utilities because they're already permitted to reconstruct, to construct, and improve under the permitted use section. You raised the issue about paper fill. Keep in mind that the Planning Commission went with the direction of a narrower buffer and to require the net to be vegetated instead of a wide buffer and allowing them to reduce that. His direction, what he wanted us to be able to allow buffer modifications, but if you go with the narrower buffer, you cannot modify the buffer. Ecology does not support paper fill. That's where you say you're going to fill part of the wetland. Then you reduce your buffer, but actually you don't fill it, but you go ahead and mitigate in other parts of the wetland. They don't approve of those, but they know cities do it, and the city has done it in the past, and there's nothing in our code that would not allow, prevent someone from doing paper fill. And Mr. Carson just wants to be able to have that option, which they can do. Staff did recommend one change, and that is to allow vehicle access to a property through a buffer if there is no other way for them to get access. Keep in mind that when you do access for a driveway, it's going to be just one point in the buffer and not reducing the entire buffer around its perimeter. So it's minimal, and occasionally we do have properties where they cannot simply get access to a buildable part of a lot because they have to go through buffer. So staff's recommending as part of this packet to allow that limited type of buffer modification for access.
Is there a width specified for that? Or?
No, they would have to do the minimum width for your buffer, your width for your driveway or roadway.
Can I have a double wide driveway? I can have a single wide driveway. You know? I mean, just saying.
Yeah. Well, we'll look at the language just to make sure it says, you know, the minimum necessary for a driveway.
For access.
Yeah. Any comments on that one type of buffer modification? And we think ecology would find that reasonable. So there was a comment about interrupted buffer waiver from Brent Carson. We had a list of things you could not. Again, an interrupted buffer is where you have a critical area, you have a buffer, and then you have a road or a building, and then you have a buffer behind it. And so that buffer, particularly for roads and large buildings, there is not the hydrological connection between the buffer that's next to the critical area and the buffer on the other side of that object. We had limited to some of the smaller improvements, such as detached garages, accessory dwelling units. We went ahead and changed that so someone could apply for it. They still may not be eligible because they have to show that improvement prevents the hydrological connection between the buffer next to the critical area and the other. We did say that you have decks and patios, you could not apply because it's very obvious that those smaller type of improvements would not do that, would not block the hydrological connection. Do you have any comments on that? Okay. Brent Carson requested that we allow 20-foot high retaining walls in the building setback. Keep in mind what's in the building setback are very low structures like ground level decks, patios, driveways, or a few narrow structures, things like a play equipment and lighting. But a 20-foot high retaining wall is basically the size of a building, the height of a building. So staff is not recommending that 20-foot high retaining walls be in those structure setbacks.
And the height of the retaining wall is the same?
Right now it's limited to 4 feet.
Which is consistent with any regardless of a buffer or anything in the code, right? It's 4 feet.
It's 4 feet, yeah. Correct. Any comments on that? Okay. And then another issue he raised.
I presume that if you had a 4 foot retaining wall and then a break and then another 4 foot retaining wall, that doesn't constitute an 8 foot retaining wall, right?
They also can only be 5 feet from the edge of the buffer. So you have your house, and you can have like a patio and then have the retaining wall as long as it's 5 feet back, because that allows for your maintenance, building, constructing of it, and maintenance of it. And that's what's already in the code. We did not change that.
Okay.
Brent Carson was concerned about on-site mitigation in city. He mentioned that occasionally he's had a situation with the Corps and fishery saying that they wanted particularly the Army Corps, that they wanted these all off-site into the watershed. Department of Ecology is in their model ordinance, the wording that we have, which is we prefer to have it in the city, either on the site or somewhere else in the city. It provides us with the storm retention area, habitat, water quality. But again, if it is not going to be a good location, then off-site is fine. And we have a set of criteria which says that, you know, as long as it, maybe the wetland is very poor quality wetland, that's a good example where they probably do better in the greater watershed and not in the city. But again, we're mirroring what ecology has in their model ordinance. So there is opportunity to have it off-site. It's just that they need to show why it's not best to have it in the city. Any questions on that? Okay. He also, Brent, asked about alternative buffer and what is it. Just keep in mind that allows a developer an alternative. It's probably only going to be used on a very large property. An alternative buffer is where they don't need to vegetate it, they don't need to maintain it, but it has to be much wider. It's one-third. And again, that comes from the ecology model ordinance. Again, we may not see these, but at least it isn't an option. And also, they don't have to do any monitoring, maintenance, security device, so it simplifies things for people. He also mentioned that he thought it was a little confusing in the nonconformance as to what people can and cannot do. If you read the whole code and you simulate it, you can understand, but staff went ahead and added a section that just basically told people they can mow their lawn, they just cannot expand their lawn. They can have all the improvements that they have, they just cannot expand those improvements. So we try to simplify and summarize sort of what you can and cannot do if you have a non-conforming property. He also asked, Brent Carson asked, that how do they prove that on-site mitigation would not be successful? And they would just do that through their critical area report using the 4 criteria. And I think if they respond to those, it will be, you know, fairly clear whether it would work on the property or if it's better to have it off-site. There's a couple changes that we have provided to you in a handout here, and I'll go through those and generally say what the wording was. First, we have the city attorney review the Chapter 90, and the first one is that currently, if you have a Process 1, which is the director decision, and at the same time your project has a 2B, which goes to the hearing examiner, 2A goes to the hearing examiner, 2B goes to the hearing examiner and city council, that you have to bump up that process so that process one under Chapter 90 would have to be bundled with those other permits because you're only allowed to have one open record hearing. Well, the city attorney also felt that the planning official decision should also be bumped up. So again, if someone has a school and they have to go through a 2B, everything in Chapter 90 would have to go to that higher level process. So we have done that and also just referenced that the criteria and the decision, the standards in the planning official decision is something that, the hearing examiner would have to analyze. We also wanted to clarify exemption under roadways into buffers for vehicular access. Again, it's that what I mentioned earlier is allowing a buffer modification so you can have a vehicular access through there. That would not be, someone would not be eligible if they're doing a reasonable use already, because they would propose that roadway going through the buffer as part of their reasonable use. Same with a wetland or stream modification. If they're already doing one for other improvements, they would not do the buffer modification going through the buffer unless that's the only thing they're proposing to do. So that's just one clarification. And then we've also listed some additional submittal requirements for the public agency exception. It's sort of like a checklist. So once a public agency comes in, they know all the different requirements and standards that they need to look at. Yes?
I have a quick question going back to 90.185, a new text on nonconformance. Legally established structures and improvements may remain and be repaired and maintained. Does that also include being replaced?
They would do, that would be under the replacement section. So that would be allowing them to, if you go just a little further down, that would allow them to tear down, rebuild, or replace. But there's some standards in there. Under maintenance or for repair, there's no standards, but under replacement, which is further down under the nonconformance, we just make sure they restore any area where they, when they rebuild, they just need to restore any area that they've disturbed.
Okay.
So maintenance repairs automatically, they can do that without, maybe potentially with a building permit, but under the replacement, they would need to come in for a permit, and the planning planner would need to look at it as part of a planning official review.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We had a letter from Crystal Wallstrom, and one thing she raised is her property has all lawn almost to the edge of the critical area. And right now, the way the code for nonconformance is written is the planning official determines whether or not where the fencing, the buffer fencing, should go. And she was concerned that there wasn't much guidance. So we went ahead and put language in there being more specific. So if someone has their entire yard is full of lawn and improvements, then they would just need to make sure there's a fence along the edge of the property line next to where the critical area is or the buffer. Probably most people maybe already have that fence, but if they don't, so they do not have to put the fence in the middle of the lawn. So so we just listed the different standards. So it would be along the edge. If they have improvements and lawn, but then they have an area that doesn't have any improvements and it's in the buffer, then the fence would need to go along that area, which is like maybe a natural area where it doesn't have improvements. So we laid out the different scenarios so that the planning official has more direct guidance. The last section is we went in and changed the vesting section, which is 90.200. The city attorney's office looked at the vesting and they said we need to change it to be more consistent with vesting law. Right now it just says that with your very first building permit, your initial building permit, you can build whatever you had under the old code that was approved. So you came in with a buffer modification before the new code went into effect, you got that first building permit. But they said, no, it needs to be tied to the lapse of approval and the permit. So we changed the vesting to meet vesting to law to state then that as long as they still have a valid permit through the lapse of approval, which in most cases it's 5 years, they have that much time to add on or whatever they want to do to the building. So probably the biggest issue we want to raise is that we want to go back to the Planning Commission's original recommendation, which is removing the non-conforming structures in the buffer when someone is doing significant development on the property. We looked at numerous sites over the past 2 weeks, and we found a lot of these sites were totally paved, particularly like up in the Totemake area. like the Uppy Pond and a few other sites, you'll see they're totally paved. The way it was written, they, because it's already paved, they could go ahead and do a new total development. They could add a five-story building. They could do all sorts of things and not have to do anything to the buffer. So we became very concerned that it is a loophole if we do. Basically, we end up with no buffer if we don't tell people they have to pull out those non-conforming improvements. So we're still using the 1,000 square feet for impervious surface. And we have another one threshold if they are adding more than 50% of the assessed assessed improvements. Then they, so that would be a major development. Then they need to bring the site into conformance. If not, we will find a lot of substantial number of developments will not have a buffer. As long as you have those improvements in there, they'll continue to use them, and then we won't have a buffer. So do you want to discuss any of that? Yes.
Well, using your example of a commercial site, and there's right. building, parking lot, and assuming that the parking lot is the amount of parking required to accommodate the building and to meet the code requirements, if they want to, in some fashion, modify the building, that requires a new building permit, and they have to pull their parking out of the buffer, and they can't comply with the parking requirements, you kind of put them in a real bind.
So basically we're saying if they totally redeveloped the site?
Not totally redeveloped, right. but, you know, did some kind of modification of the building, expanded the building, right. maybe expanded the building away from the buffer. Maybe the building's not in the buffer, but you have a lot of parking behind the building that's in the buffer. And they wanted to expand the building that would require, you know, potentially additional parking. And but now you're telling them that they have to remove a bunch of existing parking. I mean,
Well, they can choose not to build. I mean, that's the one option is just to keep what they have. But what we find then is there's no way to ever bring the buffers into conformance. We end up with no buffers. And so we feel that they should, if they choose to redevelop the site or make a significant improvement, they need to pull improvements out of the buffer.
Have you done an analysis or has anybody in the city
this
done an analysis?
This was the original recommendation that you had. That was several months ago we had discussed this, and so that was the direction of the Planning Commission. It was Brent Carson's letter. But at what point then do you say what they can keep and not keep? It ends up being very difficult, and we basically end up then not providing the buffer standards.
I would add that's probably true of any nonconformance situation where you have the 50% threshold. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for a commercial site, it's a little bit different, though, because you run the scenario that, you know, they become nonconforming because they don't have parking then, too.
I should note that we did exempt single family that go through the nonconformance provisions. They're not included. So if someone wanted to add that 1,000 square feet on the backside of their house and their house is only 750 square feet, they would not be subject to this provision, the ones that you had originally, and then the 50%, they would not be subject to that.
Are there very many commercial properties in the city that would be impacted by that?
Probably quite a few, particularly up in the Totem Lake area. Probably not in Houghton so much, because Houghton doesn't have major wetlands and streams. So right now, the one area we know is Totem Lake. There's quite a lot of nonconformances up in Totem Lake area.
Are those, I can't remember, is Bank of America?
Yeah.
Is that a nonconforming use then?
Yes.
You know?
Jeremy
knows
better than me. It's like Bank of America and the Cafe Veloce and the Yuppie Pawn Shop. Yeah, that string through there, you really have the wetland lapping right up against the parking lot.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one of the kind of poster children as we start to apply this code to that is we've written a situation in the draft we sent you that you could pretty much redevelop that site because it's all essentially all parking and never have any buffer associated with redevelopment. So that's why we kind of went back to the original Planning Commission direction and said, well, they get, there's got to be a trigger where you need to bring it into conformance.
So on those particular sites, then is there any opportunity to redevelop the property then?
I don't have a good sense of how deep the properties are. The buffer width would be.
Yeah, is the buffer 100 feet off the lake or?
Yeah, look up Sarah. You typed that.
I can't remember. It's 110.
So the gist of this is they decide if one of those businesses decides to remodel, they're going to have less parking.
Remodel's fine. It's really when you trip the 50% threshold, right? Mm-hmm. Tree said that becomes an issue. So it's a fairly significant redevelopment where it becomes an issue.
How does the code read if you change the use of a building, you know, from a restaurant to something else that requires more parking?
You have more parking? You can't. Yeah, whether it's a wetland or not, with the exception of our favorite central business district provisions for grandfather parking, but anytime, if you don't have adequate parking, you really can't have the use. So you'd have to have the ability to expand parking if the code's triggering a greater parking demand.
Would a change of use
trigger? Like an example would be office to restaurant.
Change of use wouldn't trigger anything here. Interior remodels wouldn't really trigger anything. Probably virtually take like a doubling of the floor area or more than doubling of the floor area if you take the total value of the improvements on the site.
Okay.
In response to Greg Reardon's comment, he indicated that the buffers are increasing. He's concerned right now. The buffers are generally 50 to 100 feet for the primary where he is, and they will go probably from 40 to 165. Note that the ones that are 225, it is likely we don't have any wetlands in the city that are 8 to 9. That's a very high rating one. And we have no bogs or high conservancy. So you're really looking at the range of 40 to 165. But again, as we've been saying all along, we have to update these buffers to be consistent with the Growth Management Act and best available science. So to some extent, our hands are tied on the widths of the buffers. Okay, and we went through that scenario. And next step would be if you finish your deliberations in time, we'll take it to the City Council for a study session in November. And then if they're ready for moving forward, it would be December for adoption and back to Houghton in January. And then potentially, depending on when the City Council completes their review and what they feel will go with March 1st. But that's all depending on when it is adopted. So at this point, any more questions or discussions? And then if you're ready for Houghton, then to do deliberations and make a recommendation to the Planning Commission, and then the Planning Commission make its recommendation to the City Council.
Paul and I had previously discussed the scenario if John wasn't able to get here in time, because he provided a lot of comments after the meeting. And Paul said that he would make sure that those got addressed. But now that John's here, I'm going to let John have an opportunity to make sure that his major concerns, substantive concerns, are not every comment, but the substantive comments are addressed.
Right.
And just to add, I think that many of the slides that we talked about were both response to Mr. Carson and to John's questions as well. So
I understand, yeah. Are you saying that every substantive comment John made was addressed there?
I would say, majority of them were, yes.
Okay, so can you identify the ones that weren't for John's benefit?
Well, I think the other one had to do with the interrupted buffer and the ADU. I think there was some confusion on John's part that if you have an ADU, that's considered, if you do the analysis, it could be considered an interrupted buffer based on the criteria. So it would be considered a break in the wetland if it can demonstrate that it does actually not function as a buffer.
Is that actually how it reads?
Yes.
And since I left town before I got my paper comments, I did everything on the computer, and it takes me a minute to fumble through and find those. So
I can try to find that too.
If you could help me with the right page.
Can I give Teresa a couple of housekeeping things while you're doing that?
Yeah.
Teresa, on page 2, where it says move effective date to March 1st, that should say 2017, not 2016.
Yeah.
Well, you caught us on that, huh?
Nice
and
try.
And then on page 3, at the very last sentence, right after 185, comma, that should say page 56, not age 56. Yeah. No biggies, but I know you like your stuff to look right.
So, John, the interrupted buffer discussion is on section 90.120, and the right-hand side of the packet is page 46. The left-hand side is page 34.
Oh. Can we kill the screen now that we're through the presentation?
Rick, can I make a comment?
Yeah, please. Okay. While John's reviewing that.
Yeah, I just want to thank Teresa and the team. I just feel like you've really done a thorough and thoughtful job of going through this and listening to the comments that people have raised and incorporating that as much as possible and really addressing people's concerns. And it's nice to be heard. And yeah. I feel like we're doing a service. We're trying to balance, you know, the property rights with what needs to happen and the right thing to do. And that's, it's hard work. It's very hard work. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're still looking. I'll add a couple things.
Yeah.
I'm calling for you, John. This is a really good document here, Teresa, and the way you did it, that you cross-referenced things and said it's this person comments and, you know, referred to the pages and all that. I really like that. It made it easier to follow. One thing I think I've mentioned before to staff, I know it isn't always easy, but maybe it's just not feasible at all if these things could ever get out to us sooner. I know often you're working on them up till the last minute, but if we can ever get these, sometimes I say, oh, great, I'm trying to do this, but then I'm trying to listen, and so maybe that's impossible, but that's the kind of thing that makes it easy. Sometimes say, boy, if I had this when I read the packet. Anyway, for what it's worth.
Okay.
But, yeah, thank you. This one was particularly well done with all those page references and, you know, and such.
And did you say page 46 on the right-hand side?
That's correct. Section 90.120. 1B.
B, yeah.
Yeah. Does that read okay?
Well, there's two items with that particular paragraph in my notes. One was, I think I made the note about the accessory dwelling unit during the first 12 pages of the staff's comments, but particularly on page one, on section 90.120.1.B, I think where it says retaining wall over 6 feet in height divides a portion of the property, I think we've got a little bit of a run-on sentence, and 'cause it could read over 6 feet high pertaining to some of the other items there. I think that is a bit of a run-on sentence. Also, I wrote down that it talks about a retaining wall 6 feet high in that particular instance, and later in the code it referenced 4 feet high, and so I was confused about the difference there.
The 4 feet high is what you're limited to if you, for the building setback. 6 foot high would be if you are... this is for interrupted buffers, so it could be anywhere on the site, whereas the 4 feet is the maximum height in a building setback.
Yeah, that's clear. Okay. But I still think it's a bit of a train run.
Yeah, we'll rework that.
Mm-hmm.
And the, again, just to be clear on my ADU comment, I think that an ADU is a different use besides a tool shed or a swing set or a yard or something like that. It really has viability in somebody's property, and I think is in a different category, which is what my comment was all about. And I do apologize that I was tardy and I missed the presentation or conversation on that. So,
well, I think we recognize that and built that into the code, so you can use that as a, if it's, you can demonstrate that it's an interrupted buffer if it is an ADU.
Okay.
Are there any other comments that John made that, Paul, that you can, that well, haven't been addressed?
I just quickly, we talked about the effective date, the access through the buffer for the vehicular access, the ADU, the removal of non-conforming structures, the mitigation sequencing, that, I think Teresa addressed that, the public agency exemption, the lawn mowing. So I think that's what I thought were the major ones. But, John, I can't speak for you if we captured all of them, but I think they were very similar to what Mr. Carson raised in his letter that we responded to in the presentation this evening. So you may have a copy of the slide presentation in front of you. If you can look through that, that usually has all the things that we covered in a flashing sort of way.
All right, I'll do that. That one. Okay. And then also, I probably should note for the record that Mr. Carson and I know each other professionally. I failed to disclose that last time. I don't know. We just kind of went through the meeting, but I actually know him professionally. And we do work together. I don't believe that will have any effect on my thoughts or comments on this at all. And he and I had previously not talked about any of this. So if anybody has any questions on that, please let me know.
Okay. So are we now at a point where Houghton PD Council is to deliberate on this and come up with a recommendation?
If you've had enough discussion and answered all your questions. So.
Eric.
Thank you. I flagged this earlier when Sandy brought it up. We're talking about the recording on adjacent properties of the waiver, and we're talking about what the default would be. And staff presentation was that I think the idea would be the default would be they needed to opt in basically to having it recorded, the adjacent property owners. Whereas the code is right now, they would have to object or opt out. I was just curious if anyone had any thoughts on that. And my thought was, well, it kind of cuts both ways, because the idea of this recording is to benefit the adjacent property owners. It's not restricting their rights. It's so that in the future, everyone, it's clear that they have this, you know, that their rights are not impacted. Right. So I almost wonder if we want to retain the what is in the packet, not in the presentation, but was in the packet, and have it be that they need to object. I also think that could, you know, some of the concerns that were brought up earlier were that perhaps the notice to them would not be perfect and they would not know what was going on. And I think it's sort of almost a little bit paternalistic, but having it where they would have to object almost protects the adjacent property owners from poor notice. So, but anyway, I'd be interested if anyone else has any comments to the contrary. I just started kicking it around in my head as we were talking about it.
Yeah, so you say this benefits them to have this recorded. Now, how do you?
Well, because it's what's being recorded is that. Well, I don't know. Could staff actually say that more clear than I was about to bumble through it?
It protects them from adverse impacts, so the opening the stream.
Opening the stream.
Right.
But the, and the code itself protects them, but this just
this is, so
is a security blanket for them.
Right.
Well, yeah. And actually I'm curious about that in some of the codified language. At the very end of the code, the very last, I'll see if I can scroll while I'm talking here, one of the very, very last sections talks about future codes. And it seems to be conflicting where the code that we're looking at now says that future codes may require updating of this code. And if somebody has some sort of covenant on their property that ties them down to a code, and we have a codified language that says new code usurps that, then it may be the new code that that they get forced into. It uses, if I can find it, I circled it. It uses language that says, oh, for crying out loud.
Well, I don't think this is not a covenant. It's a notice that's being recorded. But it's not a restriction on real property.
It's a broadening of rights.
Right.
It's a broadening of rights.
No.
But
it's broadening rights to a limit.
What's that?
To a limit.
Well, no, it's a notice that the daylighting of the stream does not will not impact their, or not, you know, increase the buffers for them. It won't impact their rights. This particular section, at least.
Yeah, that if daylighting results in new additional buffer or wetlands and buffers impacting their property, they're not subject to that impact.
And I think the concern is that most of the time people don't want things recorded on their property, right?
Right.
Like cloud tatter.
Well, if it's to protect them.
That's exactly.
Right, but here where it's to protect them, and we're just changing what the default is, so, yeah. I mean, they can still object. I think here it's just we could protect property owners from bad notice, insufficient notice, poorly worded notice.
So is this?
Sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
Reminds me of a little bit of the discussion about, we were talking about doing this with something else when we had, there's something about odors from farms or something that Mike was talking about. Remember, we talked about starting to get into that, and we had a discussion about, are we getting to a slippery slope where we're trying to, you know, tell everybody everything that's going on or something about their property. And
that was a little bit different because there was a restriction.
Was a warning. Yeah.
Or a warning.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a different deal. The city is going to keep track of that themselves, though, correct? It does raise an interesting question if 10 years from now that 100 foot buffer around that stream changes to a 200 foot buffer. Does that new buffer impact that property now, or?
Sure.
I think it will, Mike.
How does it? But how does it?
Well,
if he gets the first 100 feet free, does it skip over the first 100 feet, then the second 200 foot encompass it, encumbers him?
So let's hope they don't change that soon in 10 years.
Mike,
hopefully
if you look at
done with these.
Item 2 on page 62 or 74 of the packet, it says critical area boundaries subject to change. Critical area categories, ratings, classifications, and boundaries are subject to change due to amendments in this chapter or physical changes to the subject property or vicinity. Subject development on a subject property may require a change in the boundary of a critical area or the easement. It doesn't say the easement. It says or easement. It's right there. It says it'll change the easement. I don't know how it can do that, but that's what it says. It says it'll change the easement.
Mr. Kelly, could you give me the section one more time?
Here. Page 62 or 75 of the packet, item number 2 on that page, critical area boundaries subject to change.
Oh.
Well, that's due to amendments, though, that may come down the road. So you have to look at it at the time you have the amendments.
I think that's just giving notice that this code could change.
Yeah.
Right? And then if it does change, things change.
And things are changing with this set of amendments. So, I mean, it's...
Well, at any rate, I don't know if people were on board on my proposal.
I'm on board with it. I think we should give people that protection, that notification, that appropriate thing, and then if they want to opt out, they can opt out. But I think having them in first and then letting them choose out helps with someone who doesn't do a good job of notifying them, or mixed up language, or wrong zip code, and the post office never delivered it, or a failure of an email server, or whatever it is.
I concur with that.
I would agree.
On that issue of future changes, would there be anything that would designate that would in the easement? You would be referring to the course of that stream that existed at the time. That would be documented, right? So that if it were a meander, if it were to change course, they would still be grandfathered in at the original course. Isn't that the way it would work? And that would be something that's recorded, and that would be it would protect them. Am I misunderstanding that?
That's the intent. I mean, what it says is it shall not increase due to the deliberate change in the meandering course. So. The fact that you change the location of the stream shall not change that. So
right. I know that's the intent. Will there be something recorded that identifies where that stream is so that should the stream change and the boundaries and the wetland requirements, buffer requirements change, then they've got some additional protection?
Yeah, I think I understand the concern, and I think we could clarify that to say, because we could require a survey of the original course to be included in there so that we can always have that as a measurement point.
I think that's the only way to properly protect the adjacent properties.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay?
Good idea. Yeah.
All right. Did you guys, this reasonable use exemption time, the 5-year, 2-year discussion, are we good at 5 years? I know you guys have brought up the possibility of it.
I'm fine with 5 years.
Good. Are you good with 5?
Yeah.
I'd rather see the 5 rather than 2. I'd rather give people more time than less. So
yeah.
If you're good with that? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So let's move on with any further discussion on the recommendations. And John, have you had a chance to kind of see what staff's proposed modifications are? Are you?
Well, I'm trying to catch up.
Well, it's.
I also had another question about a few housekeeping items, and I don't know if that should be part of the discussion with the Planning Commission or with us.
If it's substantive, I'd like to. I think we absolutely owe it to them to have them be part of the discussion. If it's just a clerical thing, I don't know if this is important.
Okay, so what do you want to do?
If you have any substantive changes that you don't think have been addressed, then bring them up.
I'll plow through these quickly. I am on page 2 or page 14 of the packet under user guide 90.05, and it talks about being near any wetland. He used the word near in there twice, and I thought that was an ambiguous term. In the first sentence, the regulation of this chapter is to apply to activities, uses, alterations, work, and conditions in or near any wetland, and near is, I don't know.
What?
If that gets any traction with anybody, let me know. If not, I will move on.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
John, if you're going to be going through page by page, I think this is going to be
Well, I'm really sorry. I
understand.
Left before I had paper copy. And
I understand. But if you can recall from the time you've put into this the major substantive concerns you had, and we can quickly respond as to how we're
well,
being
I'm not
going
to be able to do that.
No?
I'm not
okay.
going to be able to do that.
Okay. I'm sorry, but it's unfortunate you weren't able to be here for the earlier part of the meeting. But I don't think we should hold up everybody else to have you have a private review of what's already been presented. I think I can some of the substantive things that I know you were concerned about is the deadline or the effective date, and the staff's response was that. Effectively, they've got people have had 14 months notice. They've gone through an extensive process to notify the affected parties, and furthermore, there are grants and other there's proposals that are subject to us being in compliance with state requirements. And if we don't get in compliance, then that will effectively defer or eliminate our opportunity for those grants. So delaying the effective date does have some implications on the city. So that's why they think that we're pushing it to go anything beyond making it effective March 1st, 2017. There were some clarifications that they're going to make with regard to private utilities and making sure that they're fully protected, because the way that it read, both Mike and I had concerns that it didn't. It was limited to roadways and/or recorded easements, and it didn't properly protect them. And the staff's going to make modifications to that. I had concerns about if somebody's having a total loss of their property, which requires foundation replacement, and there's going to be some clarification that they can absolutely replace the full footprint of that house. They're going to be able to replace the structure, but it may need to be relocated, and the best available, which could include having it within the buffers. But they will be able to rebuild the entire structure that they lost. My concern, and it really hasn't, there is no currently, there's nothing that addresses this, is what if that results in a significant economic impact to the homeowner who's lost their home? If the process of relocating to get them as far out of the buffers as possible creates significant additional site costs for them relocating, which is quite possible, and that's not addressed at all. There's no economic considerations in that, and that's one thing that I don't like, that it's not addressed.
But was there a discussion on the economic considerations?
Well, I brought it up, but frankly, I still have a problem with that. I feel like if somebody's lost their house, completely lost their house, short of arson. I mean, I think you clearly would not.
Well, probably self-arson.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. If somebody has an opportunity, you certainly don't want to incentivize somebody to cause arson to be able to redevelop their property in the same place. But outside of that, it seems like if somebody's been misfortunate enough to lose their house, they should be able to rebuild where it is without the risk of additional costs. And it's such an unusual situation. How many situations are there like that? It's not that significant in the big scope of things as far as the city's ability to get as much in our wetlands and buffers protected as possible, but there should be some consideration to the misfortune of the person who's lost their house. And I just think that trumps trying to get the wetlands. I think they ought to be able to relocate it right where it was, personally. That's just my personal feeling. I think those are the main things clarifications that we discussed. I think staff's done, I agree with Betsy that staff really has done an excellent job in addressing our concerns. I think you guys have gone out of your way to really consider our input and be really good at that. So, rather than me doing all the talking, any other Houghton Community Council input, discussion, and if not, I guess we could move forward with a recommendation. Yes, Elsie.
I agree with people. I feel, in my opinion, that if it's such a rare thing that the city has to do it for daylighting basements or daylighting streets, sorry guys, that the city should be in charge of notifying the residents that live along that stream.
I think they agree to that.
Yeah.
Correct? Teresa, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I just want to. Now.
Okay, Betsy?
I just need a little bit of clarification from what you guys were just talking about and the Linsenberger comments. I don't think that I saw that letter for some reason. Anyway, but it's like, it seemed like that guy got to keep his house where it was and add on to it and do all these things. So what's the difference? What's the difference between the scenarios of the house burning down and having to move it possibly and Mr. Litzenberger's concerns?
I think it's about the foundation. So it's if he wanted to save the existing foundation, or if it burned down and the foundation was intact, he could rebuild on top of it. If he wanted to tear it down to the foundation and rebuild on top of it, he could do that. But if he chooses to, of his own volition, pull out the foundation, then that's when we would trigger it to say, can you move it? Is it possible to move the foundation further away from the stream?
Right.
If it burns down and the foundation is damaged to that extent, once again, we'd say if you're rebuilding your foundation, when you're rebuilding it, you should try to locate it away from the stream. So it's really, I think the distinction comes down to what the trigger is to get that foundation moved further away from the critical area.
Yeah. Whether it's voluntary or involuntary.
But why would that make, why does that make an ecological difference? I mean, it seems like...
Well,
it's an issue of conformity that if there should be a buffer of X feet and you get one shot at it, and that's if that foundation goes away, then we're saying take the shot and try to get the foundation further away.
Okay, I see.
That's, I think that sums it up.
Which is certainly desirable. I agree with the intent. It's simply trying to balance that against, you know, the misfortune of somebody losing their house without any intent. They didn't, it's not a voluntary act. They didn't intend to change. They're not going in there and trying to make the change. It's just that their house is burned down. They just want to, it seems to me they ought to be able to rebuild it in those circumstances. But that's the difference, voluntary, involuntary. Is that, you clear that? Anything else, Betsy?
Well, it just seems weird that
Well, if somebody wants to rebuild their house, you know, and completely rebuild it, that's another story. But if somebody's lost their house, then they didn't want it. It's, they should be able
to
just...
I know. That's why I'm scratching my head over that. About why...
Why
yeah.
they are
yeah,
not
why
allowing
they are
somebody
required.
To rebuild if they've
right.
lost...
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, that's why.
Brian, anything?
No.
Okay. John, from what you know of what we've got, any...
I'm very happy that... Staff has tried really hard to come up with some ways to allow people to modify their homes using limited reports and professionals that are very expensive, going through a process on their personal residence. The part that bothers me so much is the engulfing of new property when the statement of this code really is to prevent further loss and to have no net loss. And I think because of that, some of the language in here about not allowing people to rebuild, or if they do improve their house at a certain level, they have to remove yard, and there's a loss of property when we're engulfing more property, I just cannot agree with. I just can't. That simple.
Okay.
But one more thing.
Yeah.
And I know with the deadline, and I appreciate working to push it out, but trying very hard to get a deadline so we get some sort of grant for it, I think is unfortunate as well. We did that when we did the TOD, and look what happened. So I think that, you know, it's really a shame that we have to huckledy-buck through some of these processes when we have a check dangling in front of us. So.
I'd like you to define huckledy-buck, please, for the record.
Yeah, well, I can't because apparently I can't look it up quick enough. So.
Okay, so to move this along, it from what I'm reading, everybody seems to be okay with staff's recommended changes and with the suggested changes that we've discussed here tonight in your presentation. And the only thing that I'm sensing that we may not agree with is perhaps the issue of allowing somebody to replace their home if it's destroyed and they have to just replace it, as opposed to having to relocate to the least impact on the buffers. If I'm reading that correctly, then we might take exception with that and suggest and make a recommendation that not apply, that they still be able to rebuild where their existing foundation is. Am I reading the council correctly on that?
I think so.
To rebuild where their foundation
They should be able, if somebody has a total loss, unless they have somehow been, had a part in that through arson or whatever, then they would not have the ability, then they would be able to rebuild where their existing location is without having to relocate away from the buffers. That's further from the buffers. So I think that's the only thing that we really disagree with on staff's recommendations.
I mean, it gets complicated because I guess you could look and say, well, how much actual buffer could you recoup if the house was moved? Is there a certain percentage that you have to recoup? Maybe it said that. I don't remember. And maybe there's other mitigation that you could possibly do if you don't want, if you, maybe you could move the house, but you really just, this is where the house is, this is where the tree is that you could, you know, whatever, you know. You want to keep that. Maybe there's some other little mitigation that you could do, like, okay, well, I'll sacrifice another 10 feet over here for a buffer or for whatever. I don't know. Maybe there's a way to get around that.
And that gets very subjective and complicated in trying to create language that addresses it. And that's why I think it's such an unusual situation. It probably is not going to happen very many times in the foreseeable future that in those rare instances where it should happen, I think that we just say, in consideration of what the people have already gone through, they should be enabled to, allowed to rebuild in their existing place.
Well, maybe you make an
exception that it's only they have that right. They can't sell the property and then give that right to a subsequent owner, you know. And so you make exceptions for that and for arson. And absent that, if somebody loses their home, they can rebuild there. That to me, is a logical thing. But That would be my recommendation.
Yeah.
But let's move on here. So I'm what I'm hearing is we're okay with what's been presented, staff's recommended changes, the further changes that have been discussed and agreed to through this presentation, with the exception of if there's a total loss, somebody can rebuild right where their existing place is.
I agree with that.
All right. So that would be, I would like to get a motion to recommend that from the Houghton Community Council. And we'd be making a recommendation to the Planning Commission, who then goes forward with their recommendation to the City Council.
All right. I guess I would recommend that we accept the, what's it called?
Well,
resolution?
Code amendments to Chapter 90, KZZ.
As presented, with the modifications that were discussed and agreed upon in tonight's public hearing, with the exception is we'd like to revisit the, I don't have it in front of me, the section about losing the house to fire. It's basically just fire that would cause anything like that, right?
You know, anything. It could be an earthquake. It could be anything that causes, you have to replace the structure. The foundation needs to be replaced.
It's like total loss of the structure, including the foundation.
Yeah, that it's 90.185.4b2.
And I believe the foundation reference is referenced at least twice.
Okay. So that's our motion. That's our recommendation. Is there a second?
I second.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. What the record shows, 4-1. We recommend to the Planning Commission. Eric, I'm going to turn it back to you for the public hearing on the other issues.
So I hope by now everyone's had a chance to say their piece. Is there any additional discussion on this, Mr. Miller?
Just a couple housekeeping items on page 69, and it moves into page 70, and I think 71, I'll let staff work their way through, but
of the attachment or the packet?
Packet.
No, the packet. I think the first place it shows up on page 69 would be 5A. Your code references KZC 185.3.B, and I think that should be 90.185. And then that starts repeating itself on 6. A2, well, I won't go all the way through it, but just that whole section in there, take a look at it, because there's a number of references where you should, I think you just dropped the 90.
Okay, any other discussion? I'll entertain a motion. Perhaps we should, maybe the one thing we want to discuss is the change from the Houghton, proposed and adopted by the Houghton Community Council.
Recommended,
thank you, which was to, I guess, allow the rebuild of a foundation in the event of a fire, casualty loss, stream overflowing.
I guess my question about that would be, if we make that change, are we complying with the law?
I think we have the, ultimately, ecology will tell us whether or not that passes muster. I'm not concerned about that getting flagged as an issue for ecology. We've taken some liberties with non-conformances to make this work and Kirkland specific. I think it's the community council pointed out, it's pretty rare situation, so we're not talking about a wholesale change to the environment here. We're talking about a couple exceptions here or there over the course of the next, or hopefully over the course of many years.
Ms. Miller?
I would tend to agree with the Houghton Council that that change is a reasonable change. As Jeremy just mentioned, that is such a unique situation where you're going to have a total casualty loss on a house that happens to be in the buffer of a sensitive area, that the likelihood of it happening is pretty rare. So the impact on the environment is minimal, and I don't see, as a number of members have said, a family has already experienced a pretty devastating loss, and to heap insult on injury, tell them that they can't rebuild the house in the same location is a little egregious. So I would agree with the Houghton Community Council that that provision should be changed. But beyond that, I think that the city, the staff has done an admirable job in addressing the concerns of the public, addressing the concerns of the Houghton Community Council and the Planning Commission in making changes and tweaking the ordinance to make it, I believe, workable for the city of Kirkland. Granted, there are, this type of ordinance where all of a sudden we are changing buffer widths and impacting more properties definitely has obviously a huge impact on property owners. But the staff has done, I believe, a good job in reaching out to potentially affected property owners. They've had adequate opportunity to come in and address the council. We've had a number of comment letters. And I think for tonight, as an example, the Litzberger letter, it sounds like he has more opportunity to rebuild his house than he does under the existing code. So I think overall the document in front of us with the modifications that we've are going to have the staff do and the change that the Houghton Community Council has suggested, I believe that we have a good workable ordinance.
Yeah, Mr. Singhal?
I wanted to just clarify, my understanding of the proposed new language for casualty loss is that the homeowner essentially has two choices then: either rebuild on the current footprint, or to the extent they want to move or rebuild on something other than their current footprint, then they need to apply and move to the maximum extent possible away from the critical area. Is that Do I understand the proposed language correctly?
Yes. That's how I heard it, yes.
Good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we don't want to give free rein to just do anything.
No, it would be rebuilt on the existing footprint. Yeah.
So we don't want them to improve it a little bit. kind of thinking on the fly here, when it's like, hey, my first option is to get halfway out of the buffer, but right. I don't want to get all the way out of the buffer, so I'll rebuild in the buffer. On the other hand, I don't know, I'm thinking out loud here. On the other hand, it's like, oh, now you're giving the guy all sorts of freedom, so I don't know. No, make it easy. It has to be
one or the other.
Period.
Keep it simple.
Yep.
Okay, it sounds like we're in agreement. I'm hearing that we're in agreement with what the Houghton Community Council recommended. Yes?
Somebody kind of touched on an interesting point there. I think we would draft it such that if the applicant chose to rebuild further out of the buffer, we would still have that latitude in the code. So understanding they could rebuild in the same location with casualty damage, I think that's where both groups are headed.
Yeah.
But not preclude the option by requiring them to rebuild on the same footprint.
Right. That's what I heard.
Yeah, I think the point is that if they choose not to rebuild on the current footprint, then the current language would apply. That then they have to make reasonable attempts to maximally move out of the buffer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
I would move that we recommend approval of the draft ordinance that we have in front of us with the modifications that the staff has agreed to make during the presentation, together with a modification to 9185-4B, 4B2, and that we would direct the chair to work with the staff in reviewing the language.
Okay. Second.
Fair enough.
Okay. Any further discussion on Mr. Miller's motion? I'm fine with doing that, by the way.
You can always vote no.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, all those in favor of Mr. Miller's motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, passes unanimously. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to really thank the Commission and the Council for all the work that you put into this. It's very complicated, as we know. You spent a lot of time looking at several drafts. I think we have a better product because of it. We know we don't have it perfect. We'll probably be looking at things over the next few months as we work with it and may have to come back with some tweaks next year, but I think we made a big step forward, and I appreciate all your help.
Thank you.
And I still think we should hire Mike Miller as a code writer. I mean, he's just fantastic.
he's available.
We have internships available.
Okay, I think we're on to the Mr. Whitney, if I may, I'll just move us on to the next public hearing. Okay.
Yep.
We're on to the next item on our agenda tonight. It's a public hearing on the 2016 Comprehensive Plan Amendment to the Capital Facilities Element, particularly the Capital Facility Project Tables and Text. And we have a staff presentation from Ms. Lieberman-Brill. 10 minutes.
Well, we have a pause. I want to compliment Mr. Kapler on writing those things and sending them in as a comment, because I think when I regret sometimes when people miss a meeting and they, I know they had a valuable contribution to make, but comment that I was told that by staff a long time ago. You can always send something in that, you know, people could read just, you know, it's essentially, I guess, a public comment at that point, but then you get your input in that way. So thanks for that effort, John.
You're welcome. And
next time I might read it. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
Okay. Good evening. This public hearing is about the...
Joan, could you bring your mic up a little closer?
Can you hear me?
No. Okay.
The public hearing is now about the comprehensive plan amendment to add new tables and text to the capital facility plan. First, I'll give a staff presentation, then there'll be questions and discussion by both bodies, and then we'll open the public hearing to take public comment, then we'll close the public hearing portion of the hearing, and then Houghton Community Council, once again, will deliberate and make a recommendation to the Planning Commission, and then the Planning Commission will deliberate and make a recommendation to the City Council. So... just to summarize, it's necessary to ensure consistency with the 2017 through 2022 capital improvement program, and the capital facilities plan shows the cost and the funding sources for these projects. The capital facility projects ensure that the city has adequate capacity to meet concurrency requirements, to maintain our level of service requirements, and to enhance capacity and services to the public. And just to summarize what capital facilities and services are, there are construction, acquisition, replacement of renovation of buildings, infrastructure, and major equipment. They're typically $50,000 or more and have a long-term lifespan. They're a fixed asset, and the examples that are up there are shown to give you an idea of what those capital facilities would be. The revised project tables were adopted, just to get you up to date, we're going to be looking later in the evening, the Houghton Community Council will be looking at making final approval of one of the tables that you looked at in September. And this was the facility table. And it was omitted from the 2035 update inadvertently. And once that is adopted, finally adopted this evening, we would recommend that it is by resolution. Then the current 6-year CFP and 6-year CIP will be up to date, and they'll be consistent. And now what we're working on is updating all the tables in the capital facilities plan, all the project tables, so that they will be consistent with the new 6-year CIP, 2017 through 2022. And so that's the public hearing is on these new tables, all of them, that are contained in the capital facilities plan. And we're also doing minor text changes to reflect the addition of that facility table, CF10. So the highlights for 2017 include funding for future CIP projects to meet new critical area ordinance and stormwater design manual requirements so that the capital facility folks can do the type of background investigation that now will be required to meet these new regulations. And also, we have shown funding for the Fire Station 24 replacement that's going to apparently be starting in 2018. We have here staff from the Finance Department, Tom Mitzkel and Rod Steitzer from Public Works, if you have any questions regarding those projects. And then the adoption of the CFP, the Capital Facilities Plan, tables and text amendments, would be concurrent with the 2017 through 2018 biennial budget and six-year 2017 through 2022 capital improvement program, the CIP, and this they will be adopted in December concurrently with this change to the capital facilities plan. So if you have any questions, I can entertain those now.
Any questions?
Did anyone sign up to give public comment on this tonight?
I would note that the City Council also holds a public hearing on the CIP project.
So. Okay, great. Is there anyone in the audience tonight who'd like to give public comment on this item that did not have the opportunity to sign up? Okay, in that case, we will close the public hearing and deliberate. Mr. Whitney, you want to lead us through this?
We've already been through all this. Does anybody have any further questions? And if not, I would entertain a motion to approve the amendments.
I move we approve. Where is it? The city initiated comprehensive plan amendment for the capital facilities element. File CAM16-02301.
Is there a second? Second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries. Cheers, Eric.
Okay. Any further discussion on the Planning Commission or by the part of the Planning Commission? No. Okay. In that case, I will entertain a motion.
I would move that we approve the amendment to the capital facilities element, capital facility plan tables and associated text, file CAM16-02301.
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Okay, any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of Mr. Pruitt's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None. Thank you so much. See? Under 10 minutes.
Good job.
Eric, good job, Eric.
The next item on our agenda tonight is a public hearing on zoning code amendments to low impact development regulations. And we have Dorian Collins and Ms. Rush to give a presentation.
Good evening. That is, I'm finding that really hard to stare at, that blinking. So let's go.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Yeah, because that's. But you all have a paper copy, right?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
Okay. That's what we're used to working with anyway, and this blinking is just really
yeah,
bad.
I know. I'm Stacy Rush, a stormwater engineer in Public Works. And tonight, for the agenda for tonight for the LID code revision part, we're going to do the staff presentation, questions, then the public comments, and then we'll close the hearing so you guys can do your deliberation, and then hopefully we'll get some recommendations. Now, we initially brought these changes to you back on September 29th to the study session, and then since then, we've gone to both the council subcommittees on October 5th and October 10th, and we had a well-attended public open house earlier this evening, and we've done a bunch of other outreach kind of list there, but I don't need to read it all off. We've done lots of outreach, and we've started getting comments. As of this morning, we'd only had one comment letter, but I know Dorian received a couple, or just one more email tonight. So we're getting a little bit of comments. So now in the next couple of slides, I'll be quick, but I want to go through Kirkland Stormwater Permit, which is what required us to do these code revisions, the zoning code amendments that staff is proposing, and some extra changes to the municipal code and the standard details and policies. So our NPDES Stormwater Permit, NPDES stands for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, and that originated from the Clean Water Act, but our permit requires that if the city takes actions to improve the quality of stormwater. And as long as we take those actions, then we can discharge to streams, lakes, and wetlands. So one of the requirements is that we were required to look in our code and look for ways to come up to minimize impervious surface, to minimize loss of native vegetation, and to minimize the overall amount of stormwater from development. And definitely the intent of the permit is to make LID the preferred and commonly used approach. And so you might ask why. Well, this is because we know that untreated stormwater runoff is toxic to fish, and it's the largest source of pollution to Puget Sound. But routing stormwater through vegetation and soil provides the treatment and reduces the toxicity of stormwater. So we spent about this year reviewing our codes and looking for ways that we could incorporate low-impact development. What we found is that Kirkland has been pretty proactive. We're pretty good. We already have a lot of LID in our codes, but there were a few more things that we could do. So we identified three zoning chapters where we could make some changes. And that's what we're proposing to you tonight. So now I will turn the presentation over to Deb Powers, our urban forester. Oh, let me hit one more.
Deb Powers, urban forester. So at our the September 29th study session, there was a discussion about how we were calculating tree credits for conifers, the retention and planting of. We wanted to incentivize retention of and planting of conifers because they provide a superior mitigation of stormwater in that they transpire, et cetera. More so than deciduous trees. So we included the some language in the tree credit table and in the example underneath it, and we increased the retention of conifer tree credits by 1.5 to incentivize that. I think there was also, so on Chapter 95, Section 9544 was the discussion about a superior parking lot design. And we, there, the discussion was, had to do with an idealized parking lot that had park-like open space in the parking lot. And while that is exactly how it was touted as a out-of-the-box thinking approach to parking lots, we decided that the preference for that design is out of the project scope and that we would later study it if and we could address it with a miscellaneous code amendment. So Stacy was right in that the city of Kirkland has a lot already in codes to address surface water, or I'm sorry, stormwater mitigation, especially in Chapter 95, where there is a lot of language having to do with soil retention by the way of tree retention. So aside from the first and the last that we just talked about, the parking lots and the incentivized conifer retention, we cleaned up some sections that had to do with some outdated language having to do with best available science and best management practices for soil. We decided that there was no reference to the Public Works pre-approved plans. So to have gain more consistency and clarity, we made sure that we included language to connect the use of the pre-approved plans for LID. And that we also, even though there was some preference for native species, we, looking at it through the lens of LID, we made sure that that was pretty consistent through Chapter 95. So with that, that was the aspects of Chapter 95 in regards to LID. And so I'll introduce Dorian Collins.
So there are also some amendments proposed for Chapter 114, which is the low-impact development chapter in the zoning code. And this chapter was created in 2008 prior to when LID facilities were not required as part of traditional development. And now that they are required under the new surface water design manual, the incentives need to be removed. But there are other benefits to retaining this chapter, as there are other beneficial items that are included in these regulations, so those should be retained. There were some issues raised at the last meeting. A couple of members wondered about the proposed requirement for a native tree and plant plan in the areas with existing native vegetation. And we took a closer look at the existing text, and in the areas in the current requirements, in areas with no existing native vegetation, the current requirement calls for a restoration plan. And so staff would propose that we would use that same language rather than the native tree and plant plan. So that's would be our suggestion to respond to that question. And then there was also, there were questions about that requirement for 80% landscape coverage within 2 years. And that is a standard existing requirement in Chapter 95 for other areas. It applies to supplemental planting for commercial, multifamily, industrial properties for land that's not covered by a building, vehicle circulation area within a critical area are committed to another specific purpose. So while there may be some interest in revisiting that general requirement, staff would recommend not doing that at this time because that could have implications beyond the scope of this project. But that also could be included in a later miscellaneous code amendment study. So the proposed amendments are various changes to replace the incentives with requirements in Chapter 114, to require the preservation of native and undisturbed vegetation in these projects that choose to use Chapter 114 for development, and then in the common open space to require the restoration plans to achieve 80% land coverage in 2 years, and then also to provide a simplified review process for the 2 and 3 unit homes. In Chapter 115, Section 115.90 deals with lot coverage and calculation of lot coverage and provides exceptions and exemptions to items that are not included in lot coverage that provide benefits, low-impact development types of benefits. And there was an issue raised at the study session regarding the definition for maximum lot coverage. Well, really just a suggestion that we could include a reference to the new surface water design manual standards in the definition for maximum lot coverage. And since at the last study session, you may recall that we talked about the concept of possibly regulating open space versus lot coverage and kind of flipping how that is done. And this definition may be part of that discussion, and there may be additional changes related to that. So again, we'd recommend that that suggestion kind of be retained and be included in that later study. So the proposed amendments to this section, 115.90, are the same that we discussed at the study session, that there would be two new exceptions. One for rockeries and retaining walls located adjacent to or within 12 inches of another impervious surface, and another new exception for public sidewalks that are placed on private property to be included in a public easement, so that that would not be included in lot coverage, which would create a new burden on private property. And then the other amendments would be to eliminate the section that provides for incentives, LID incentives, because these would now be requirements under the new surface water design manual. So those would need to be removed from this section.
Dorian?
Yeah.
Under those exemptions that you're deleting here, like permeable pavement, the modular grid pavement, and so on. So in the new surface water manual or someplace, is the city going to require, like, driveways, all driveways be permeable concrete?
Yes, pervious.
Or pervious, yeah. I'm sorry.
As much pervious, as is feasible, yeah.
Infeasible. What does that mean?
If the soils beneath the pavement can soak up water, then the porous pavement would be required.
Yeah, but typically if somebody's building a driveway, they're going to compact the soil so the driveway doesn't sink, so...
What you do with pervious pavement, if the soils beneath infiltrate water pretty well, is you actually put a rock bed between the soil and the pervious pavement that stores water and then allows it to soak into the soil.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay.
There's also the feasibility if the driveway...
Stacy, we need you on the mic if you're going to...
Oh. I was just going to say there's some other infeasibility criteria for porous pavement, like if it's too steep, because there's certain... slopes that porous pavement doesn't work on.
Which are very shallow, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? Well, like 12% is like the max, and that's only with certain paver products. 5% and 2% are better.
Why doesn't it work on steep ones?
Because the water runs off too quickly.
Oh, why doesn't it? I thought you said
yeah. So it's in up. Okay. Yeah, because
The water will just shoot through. It doesn't have time to infiltrate down.
Got it.
The bottom line is it's required in the stormwater manual.
Right, so okay. There's no, it doesn't make sense to contain incentives anymore in the code. So now, Stacy. Oh.
It's required and it is calculated at 100%.
That's correct. Or 9-10?
No, you mean for surface water modeling? Like when you're deciding how big to make your...
For coverage.
Oh.
For lot coverage. It's required. What I heard you say is it's required and it counts as 100% coverage.
Yes, for zoning lot coverage. In the stormwater manual, if you're doing it for modeling to, like, reduce the size of your detention system, then you're allowed to use a credit of 50-50.
Yeah, and these may be some things that when we do this later study of looking at open space versus lot coverage, that we'll have another opportunity to look at how these things are considered in the zoning code, whether or not the 50%, you know, we'll be having another chance to look at that.
So then there's just real quick, there's just a couple other changes that we're making. We're making one change to one municipal code, and this is more of a housekeeping issue to make sure so that it's consistent with what the zoning code refers to, which is our Public Works pre-approved plans. And then under the Public Works plans, those are our standard plans and policies for development, and those are revised on an annual basis, and so we'll make some revisions in the next annual update that'll be January 2017. So, that we're required by our stormwater permit for the code changes to be effective December 31st, so that's why we're bringing it to you. And our next step is to take it to Kirkland City Council on November 15th. We're on the agenda, and then depending on if they adopt it then we'll come back to Houghton Community Council. If we have to go again a second time to Kirkland Council in December, then we might have to come back to Houghton in January. But we're trying to get it all done before the end of the year. And so, you have questions? I know there's at least one person that wants to speak at the appeal. So I don't know if you want to do questions first, or is that the usual process?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess just questions now, not deliberating.
Back to the very beginning. My understanding of this is that in order to comply with the NPDES permit, we had to review the code and find areas. Are there any parameters to that, such as, that seems pretty vague to me. I guess what I'm saying is, I mean, is there a parameter like, does LID make sense in this area? Does it not make sense in this area? I mean, what if we just said, well, we looked and we didn't find anything?
We have that option. There was no requirement of exactly like how many. There wasn't like a certain minimum criteria of you have to change 10 codes or you have to do something. We were just supposed to make a good faith effort and go through all our codes and find ones where it looked like we could better incorporate LID into development. And so, Jenny, do you want to elaborate on that?
There was also extensive guidance from Ecology on sort of what they saw as the ideal. And so that's what we used to compare to when developing the gap analysis.
Yeah, that's a good point, that they had what the ideal would like, and so.
And I think what we said earlier on, the city has actually done a lot of this ahead of time, so we're ahead of the game, and our gap analysis showed that we've done quite a few things to really promote LID, and now there's some final touches we need to make to bring it up to speed.
Yeah, I was actually at a meeting last week for the region with a bunch of other cities, and a lot of other cities are making like changes to 100 different things and 150 codes. I mean, they have a lot of zoning code changes. We're actually in pretty good shape. Yes.
Have you assessed how many or how big is the impact based on historical permitting patterns for removal of the LID incentives?
Ooh, I don't know that we've done. I don't think so.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Yeah. Has there been any estimation done on sort of what percentage of historical permits, say over the last year or 2 years, would have been rejected had the LID incentives not been in place? I'm trying to get a sense of how big of an impact is the removal of the LID incentives on sort of current construction practices and permitting.
Well, I know I don't have a number for that, but I know we've had a lot of projects come in, and they were pushing their lot coverage with their house, so that's why they go to pervious pavement with the driveway, and that's come up a lot.
That's pretty common.
Yeah, and sometimes those even come after the fact. It's like they've already built the house, and then they're going back, oh, we're already at our lot coverage, so sometimes it comes in even after the fact. It wasn't in the original design, and so it's just getting bigger and bigger houses.
Oh, that brings up something.
Yeah.
So is this going to encourage bigger houses?
No, because it's removed from the lot coverage, they're going to have to go back to what they originally, the 50% maximum lot coverage. What was happening is the houses were being built bigger, and they were already at the 50%, so they're like, oh, let's throw in this porous pavement, and then we at least get a 50-foot of credit so that we can keep building the bigger houses. It wasn't achieving, our whole point of putting it as an incentive was to have more LID be built. But the effect of it, of offering the incentive, was we're just getting bigger houses. We're not really getting any less lot coverage or anything.
Lot coverage, because every time you put impervious service in, you get a benefit from that, regardless of what the house does. So you can't say the result was you got bigger houses.
Well, but yes, I think you can, because if...
Yeah.
Yeah, because if part of your impervious surface was your driveway, and so you're adding that onto the house now because you're getting this incentive for a holy driveway. So you got a bigger house and a holy driveway, but you're getting a monster house. So
I think we're just trying to take questions for staff now.
But I mean, my question is, will this prevent that from happening?
Well, it's not going to prevent porous pavement, because under the manual, every house is going to have to look at doing a porous pavement driveway or routing the driveway to an infiltration trench or bioretention.
But
or
it
something
won't
else.
Count then as part of the house.
So it'll count. Well, it'll be used for stormwater of the whole house. But yeah, it won't count for a lot it won't be, it'll count towards lot coverage. The driveway will. Doesn't matter what material the driveway is made of.
Thank you.
Because we felt like we were getting an incentive for something that's required, and then they might be taking in a double benefit of counting it, getting a break on lot coverage, and being able to reduce their detention system.
Great.
So you just mentioned infiltration trench. So is that what steep driveways are going to have then?
Steep driveways are going to be harder. They're going to need to route it somewhere. Well, no, they'll fit on. Well, the steep driveway, they won't have to do porous pavement because that'll be under the LID feasibility criteria. It says what the slopes need to be. So their options are going to be captured at the bottom and then maybe route it to bioretention, like a rain garden, or put an infiltration trench. You could put it maybe in the lawn right next to the sidewalk or something at the bottom of the slope. So something like that. And they're going to have to come
should
up with...
Should the soils allow?
Yes, if the soils are not good. It could be that the project can't do any... LID's not feasible at all if the soils are really bad. But the soils would have to be less... They'd have to have an infiltration rate of less than 0.3 inches per hour, which is pretty low.
Come over to my house sometime. I think I got all these problems.
Yeah, right, so it's going to force the engineers to kind of look at more things and to kind of consider more things.
Okay. Any other questions?
I got a question about this 80%. I mean, when you say achieve 80% coverage of, within 2 years, I mean, that's like projected or based on the species? Are there some criteria or there's some manual that says this sort of thing will grow this fast or this? How is this judged?
I think it's going to be a reasonableness criteria for when stuff is planted. And then I don't know if we're going to have inspections to go back out after the 2 years. Not sure that that's been decided yet. But again, that's only for the projects that go for that extra bonus density and use the LID code, the 114. That's not going to be every project.
Okay.
And we've had, I think, 3 or 4 in the last few years use that code. So it's not going to be every, you're not going to have every house that has to do 80% coverage.
Okay.
And we felt that was a good benefit for getting the density benefit to have a little bit better vegetation. Yes.
A couple of questions. So I'm now confused. Is the permeable pavement required, or is it one tool that they can use?
Depends on which approach. The surface water design manual has what's called a list approach, where you go down through and it's like an if then. You know, can you do this? Yes, no. And the advantage to that is if you have a smaller project, you do not need to do modeling. You always have the option of doing modeling, and then you can choose whatever set of LID facilities you want to use. And so, it's one tool in the toolbox, but if you use that list approach, most of the time you're going to end up with that for your driveways.
Got it. And then the second one is I had the same question on the coverage.
The 80%.
On how is coverage defined? So if you have a tree canopy that covers an area, that's very different than a bunch of small ground cover planted as a certain percent spacing. In 2 years, it's going to cover a certain amount. What is cover? Is it defined, and how is it defined?
Is it actually defined in the zoning code? I mean, we took it from Chapter 95. And again, there's that reasonable. So we don't want just like an entire beauty bark area. We want plants. Go ahead.
There are some standards, like there has to be one tree every 1,000 feet, and then there has to be living ground cover. But the canopy counts. So, if there's a canopy and then other.
And so plants. If it's 80% in 2 years, is it a typical canopy in 2 years?
Do you have a sense of that?
I think when this question came up before, I think Jeremy weighed in on it that it wasn't some, I mean, it's been in place in Chapter 95, but not strictly inspected or measured. No?
The code does say that if after 2 years it's not, it hasn't reached the 80%, that needs to be immediately corrected. So I think the understanding is we will
Right.
I don't think your voices are getting recorded. They're not picking up on the mics.
Dorian's wasn't.
And that's my point, is now that it does need to be reviewed, it's really about managing expectations. I mean, you know, the development world and the homeowners need to have an expectation of what they need to hit and what really is 80%. That's all. So it sounds like it kind of is, but it kind of isn't. So.
Well, I would say this is not at all a new requirement. It's only new to Chapter 114, and it's only new in applying to the project that choose to use that. It's a requirement throughout the city for all areas that aren't occupied by a building. So all commercial properties all have this requirement, and it's been in place for years. So the definition of this is not what we're trying to do at this point. We're just applying the existing criteria. Okay. So, again, if that's something that you want to revisit, we could maybe do that in a subsequent code project. But.
Yeah, and typically the way you measure 80% cover is there are certain sort of standard ecological methods. They come out with like a frame of a certain size and put the frame down, and you get training in how to do this, but and then you measure, you know, what's the percentage cover of ground cover, what's the percentage of shrubs, what's the percentage of tree cover, and then you combine all that together to get a total cover. So there are some fairly standardized ecological methods for looking at cover, and I would assume that that's similar to what we would use.
And I think that the intent was that it was ample, that it wasn't sparse, and then it wasn't overplanted, so that in 2 years, 80% was sufficient, rather than starting off with overcrowded situation after a couple of years.
I just want to throw in, I'm not a landscaper, but I've done a lot of landscaping of apartment properties over 30 years, and I can tell you that the growth is exponential beyond the first 2 years. And so you're kind of setting yourself up for terrible overgrowth by having an 80% requirement in 2 years. I do have a problem with that, but I understand this isn't the time and place to do it. I'd like you to consider reevaluating that for future minor code revisions, because I do think I just think it's problematic.
Can somebody grab this sign-in sheet for me? I think we have at least one person signed in. Oh, okay.
You said you wanted to speak, but you haven't signed
in. Oh, you can sign in after.
Okay.
That's fine.
Yeah, so.
If you would just, so we'll now take public comment. If you just want to step up to the podium there and state your name and address for the record. When you're done, if you could fill out the paper.
Thanks. I'm Aarti, and we are planning to build in Kirkland soon. We are very new to Kirkland, and, you know, it's the whole thing is very confusing, all the codes and, you know, all the, like, you know, different implementations. And this LID is really confusing to us. So, because, you know, I've been asking a lot of questions, but, like, there is no clear answer to all these questions. And we are in, like, you know, designing phase. Like, we haven't even really started designing yet. But this thing is going to hit us, you know, first. Because, you know, we might be submitting our permit in January. And this code is implementing, if it gets approved, you know, it would be implementing around January, right?
Yes.
Right? So it's going to hit us first, right? So without any clarifications and without any details, I don't know, like, you know, how much financial cost it would be adding to my project. So I have a question to city, like, you know, what is city considering, like, how are you considering to make it easy for, you know, residents? Is there going to be any financial help from city? Is there, like, yeah, you know, it could be, because, you know, I did not plan for it. I did not plan for this cost. So I'm prepared for other costs, whatever, you know, I've been told, okay, Kirkland has this law, you know, this code, you have to, okay. But something new, I did not plan. So my first question to you, how much cost it's going to add to my project? Do you have any, like, you know, any rough number?
We don't, I mean, so I don't think we're, nobody here is probably able to speak to your particular project. I recommend that you work with staff to understand what, how
but
the code will impact
you. They don't
you.
Know. No one knows. Oh. And
well,
yeah, because, you know,
I'm not sure
I don't
true.
Have much time. If like this code is implementing in January, how many, it's October, Thanksgiving is around the corner, and then Christmas.
I understand. So this is an opportunity to give public comment. We try not to have discussions during this. I think everyone hears loud and clear your frustrations.
Yeah.
And the second question,
I'm not done
them.
Yet.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, I think someone wants to. Yeah, sir, please.
I only want to comment that if you're able to get your application in before the code takes effect, then you would be grandfathered in.
That's
you would
what
not
I'm
be
saying.
Subject to the new
that,
requirements.
That's the best case we are talking about.
Yeah.
But if what if, you know, I'm not, I don't belong to the best case.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a basic thing. I work on software projects. The cost is something we estimate first. And we tell, you know, whosoever is going to pay that cost, we tell them this is the estimated number. And we are the one, we are going to pay the cost, but nobody knows the number.
Right.
But still, you know, it's coming out of our pocket, okay? And the second thing, you know, like there's a fire amendment, like there's a code, I think, if I'm not wrong, I don't know much about the codes. And, like, you know, if your house is that far from the fire, fire station, then, you know, you can become an exception, you know, okay, you don't really need to put sprinklers, and there are amendments. So, and, you know, if your water consumption is over, like, you know, this much, then city would help you, I think, with the part of cost to put some water usage, and I don't know, like there are amendments to code. So my question to you is, what are the amendments to this code? If my house is close to fire preserve, or if my house is very close to the park, like there are some exceptions, okay? If you're 100 meters away from the fire forest preserve, then you don't really need to, you know, put this LID. Are there any amendments to this code?
Okay, thank you so much for sharing with us tonight. We really appreciate it. If you could fill out the sign-in sheet when you're done, and if you have, I would invite you to follow up with us by email,
mm-hmm.
and follow up with staff, and you know, everyone on the commission checks their email, and I know staff is very responsive, so thank you so much for sharing tonight, though.
Thank you.
Maybe if I can just clarify, too, there is a pre-application meeting that they can request to sit down with the various staff representatives and go through their process, and I think we're willing to sit down with her as well from the standpoint of what the code may do to her individual case, but not knowing the exact circumstances, but there is a procedure for them to follow to try to answer her questions.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience tonight who would like to give public comment on this issue? Okay. Then we will close the public hearing, and the commission, Planning Commission and the Houghton Community Council will now deliberate. I think we'll follow the same pattern as before if you guys want to go first.
Okay. All right. So this is an opportunity for us to discuss any issues we have, any concerns. Elsie, is there anything in particular that you have a problem with as far as what's being recommended?
No.
Okay, Betsy?
No, I feel like we thoroughly discussed this, and yeah. I agree with you on the 80% on the tree things, because with the plantings I've done, it takes them a couple years to even get going, and then they go crazy. So,
right.
Save
it for another day.
Yeah, another day, and I think I'm fine with what they've proposed.
Brian?
The only question that came up in my mind was, now that it's being required, if there's any estimates on maintenance, because I remember us discussing there is a good deal more maintenance on permeable or holy pavement. Mm. Like, Betsy.
Holy pavement back then.
And I would just be interested on additional costs and maintenance that probably doesn't fall under this at the moment, but I think it would be good to be out there in the public so that when people are estimating their costs, it's not just construction but also maintenance.
Okay. Do you see that in any suggestion to modification of what we're codifying, or are you saying?
No, I'm in agreement with what we're codifying. Yeah. It's just a concern.
Got it. Okay. John?
I'm just confused on the new exemption or the exemptions being deleted for permeable payment for the 50% reduction. And I misstated earlier about what I should have said wholly being making the homes bigger, because there is added benefit, and it has to do with patios and rear yards, that sort of thing. So I'd like that reconsidered again, and I must confess I'm not 100% sure on how which path you take triggers what. I do know that our office does almost everything pavers or some pervious pavement, and I do know there's benefit for it, and I know that and Stacy and I have talked about this a lot in the past. I have a lot of it on my property. I've tried different techniques of LID, and I monitor it every time there's a rainstorm. I go out and I look at the way different things work so I can see what works better, and I think that allowing permeable pavement and incentivizing it by a reduction is a good thing, because so I'd like that relooked at.
Are you suggesting that we actually make some changes, or just want to see it?
I should say discussed a little further, because I would like it changed. I do think it could go back in.
Yeah.
And I'd like us to discuss that.
What's your recommendation, John?
My recommendation would be to leave that section of the code as it was for, because it's not just permeable pavement, it's decking, decking with spaces in it. So anybody that has a deck with a space in it, and so the lots are getting smaller, and the homes are getting bigger. It's a factor of financial issue. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why the homes are getting bigger, but at the end of the day, homes are getting bigger because people want bigger homes. And then to tie down so severely, adding even a deck on the back of a house because it's counted as 100% pervious with open decking in it, I think we need to provide more options. So I would like to have the reduction in there. Now, maybe we couple that with, if we use it as reduction, there has to be some sort of way that it's mitigated with, so we don't just allow the storm to run off the property, because that's a horrible thing. That's a horrible, horrible thing. And it's just as bad as we've discussed many times, just to put it in a pipe and run it to the lake, because we really need to keep it on the property where the bugs and bunnies need it. So how do we do that? Is it some sort of, underground pipe that trickles out? Is it some sort of rain garden? Is it something that people put on their property? And maybe this is one of those paths that I'm ignorant of. I nod your head if it is. And that also brings back to a point of what the lady spoke about tonight, is managing expectations on these new codes so people can understand what they can have on their property. That's very, very important to me. Very important to me. It shouldn't be, let's go through the process and figure out what the result is. Let's know what the expected result is and how to get there. So I think that's important.
Okay. So you've given us your, in theory, do you have a specific modification, or are you just saying remove 115.90.3?
That's the simplest in my mind, and if there's pushback on it, maybe we attach something to it that it's got to be mitigated with some sort of storm detention or LID to substantiate it or something. it's just harder and harder. We have harder property to build on. It's steeper. It's encumbered. It's sensitive. There's bad soils, all sorts of things, and we're trying to get houses on them, and it's just harder and harder and harder to do, and we're taking away tools that allow us ability to do it. So I'd like to see as many tools as possible to allow us to do it. So on its simple face, I guess I'd propose leaving this back in, and if anybody has any comments, certainly in our group or on the Planning Commission group, mitigating it, I'd be open for that.
Okay. That's a pretty substantial change to what's being proposed. Thoughts? Feedback? The rest of the council?
I guess we'd need to hear from staff how that would change this whole thing.
I think we would need to hear from staff how extensive of a change that is.
You want to, staff want to comment to John's suggestion?
It doesn't make so much of a difference with stormwater, because what we were trying to do was separate stormwater credits from lot coverage credits to try to separate them, because there seemed to be a lot of misunderstandings from applicants when we tried to merge them. We tried to do get to merge them and make it easier, but as far as stormwater goes, we still have that thing that we can't offer incentives for something that is required. So if we change that and still offer the incentive, I guess we would need to check to see if does that do anything with putting us out of compliance. I don't know. And then also for planning, because for planning lot coverage, I think it gets into what you want to see for lot coverage and for cover. Like if there's a hard surface there or even a pervious pavement, visually, it looks like a hard surface. Is that what planning was kind of going for? So I would look to Paul to kind of explain a little more of lot coverage.
Well, I think it maybe Betsy kind of hit upon the point. It does would result in some increase in coverage, whether it's a pervious surface or the unit itself. So that's kind of the trade-off and the debate that you have to have. We're in that area now where we're starting to talk about what's impervious, what's lot coverage, and what's open space. So that's a debate we need to have, because when it was set up originally, we talked about maximum lot coverage, which did both. It did both the impervious surface and the open space standard. So I guess it's maybe a question that we could come back to when we address the miscellaneous code amendments to try to determine, what is it we're trying to accomplish here. But I think it would result in increased area, which then makes it even more difficult to deal with the stormwater.
If I could add a follow-up to that, I see also some modifications regarding the lot area that is dedicated for access easements to property is taken out, and that coverage has been taken out. So what part of it didn't say which coverage is taken out, the whole access easement or just the part that's paved?
Dorian would need to address that one.
Are you referring to the sidewalk?
No, provision? I'm referring to the access easement.
What page is that?
Let me find it. What section?
Okay, 53. Attachment 3. Isn't that where you're at, John?
Yeah, I wrote it down here because... Page 53, right? Yeah. Right.
Section 115.90.2.A? Because there's no change proposed there. The
right.
change is in D and E.
Yeah.
So the only change is E is
sidewalk located.
Adding that ability, the flexibility to exempt the public easement on private property.
Right.
The text that is in black is.
Sorry,
existing.
I misread that.
Yeah. That's fine. It's underlined because it's a link.
No. Yeah. Sorry, I misread that.
I do want
to
say...
To answer the question, I think we calculate the whole access easement, right?
Whether it's paved or not?
Yeah.
Well, no. Historically, it's been what's paved.
What's paved.
What's paved.
That would make sense.
Yeah. What's paved. Although Mercer Island... counts the whole easement, whether it's paved or landscaped or not. They count the whole easement as covered, which seems kind of silly. But in Kirkland, it's just been the part that's paved.
Okay, so we're really looking at more than just the stormwater. I think you were saying that it wasn't so much a stormwater as the lot coverage issue with what John's addressing here. Mm-hmm. So we really have two different goals that we're seeking to mm-hmm. achieve. So really, that's the thing that we're looking at, and whether or not to consider John's suggestion that we recommend not removing 115.90.3.
I do want to just add one thing that certain third parties are going through cities, and like Puget Sound Keepers is one of them, but there's other third parties that are kind of looking at cities' changes, and we don't want to give the appearance that we're offering an incentive for something's required, because that's something that they could target just because they don't want to see that. So,
well, yes.
Well, maybe we don't call it an incentive, but we call it an exemption, or,
yeah.
I mean, we say except in this case, or I mean, just a thought.
Yeah, John.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Go.
Yeah, glad to meet you, Rick.
All right.
Why don't I get back to the discussion about what did allowing that cause? And Stacy was right on, I think, when she said, well, we put that in there, all we got was bigger houses. I mean, maybe it isn't all we got, but I'm sure we did, because that's what they're building. And you know, as I've admitted to some I bought last year, one of those big honking houses, which is bigger than I wanted, but with the price of land or the price of a teardown, you know, that's what builders did. They want to jam every square foot on there, and I have a steep driveway, so I don't have a pervious pavement, but I do indeed think that, you know, that is one result of that, which I know is something that Betsy laments, that we're going to have a bunch of 4,000 square foot houses all over town and nothing, you know, and nothing else. So I absolutely think that is one of the a strong effect of you know, allowing that. That said, I will say, I've always been a little skeptical of pervious pavement. I talked to somebody briefly who worked somehow in that industry, who was also had some connection, who was also skeptical, like, how pervious is this stuff going to be, really? I don't know if it's been, how well this stuff's been tested, but I just, I look at that stuff and say, come on, isn't that going to fill with dirt and something, or whatever. I don't know, but, you know, that's an aside. If it's been proven, fine. But anyway, I think allowing it does make bigger houses in many cases.
Well, to the extent that the science is somewhat unproven or still in question, it might tend to support the idea that maybe we should leave it as. Yeah, I think that's what you're saying.
Yes, that
right.
Was. I'm sorry.
And yes, sorry about that, Glenn.
Thank you for making that connection, which
okay,
I meant
good.
To make too.
Okay. You guys have any other comments you want to? Because I would love to get your input before we make a recommendation, particularly on this, on John's recommendation.
That's a fair point. Any other comments, Mr. Miller?
I can understand the staff's position on the exemptions, eliminating the exemptions on for A, B, and D, but the open grid decking is what kind of baffles me, because in 2B. We have an exception for pervious areas below eaves, balconies, and other cantilevered portions of buildings. So presumably a deck, if it's cantilevered, is exempt. But if you have a couple posts holding it up, it's not exempt. That doesn't really make any sense. And that would be one exception I would think that we would want to keep in, and maybe just eliminate paragraph 3 and stick it up under paragraph 2. But that one, I would think, should be left in.
When we reviewed these with the current planners, they pointed out they've had some problems where there's open grid decking over a pervious area, but the pervious area is locked or kind of landlocked or whatever, surrounded by paved areas. So there might be, you know, a very small area. I mean, it sounds, it's probably rare, but they said that they encounter this frequently. And so it's really not an opportunity for that water. It gets stopped on all sides. And I saw an example of a plant.
We're talking about water going down into the soil, not running off.
Hmm?
We're talking about water going down into the soil, not running off. If it runs off, then theoretically it's impervious.
I know they had, I'm trying to remember, there were some sketches they had where they were saying it had been a problem.
My point is, isn't an argument over whether or not the ground underneath the deck is pervious or impervious. It's really a comparison to 2B, where you talk about pervious areas below eaves, balconies, and other cantilevered portions of the buildings. You can have a cantilevered portion and have the same situation you just described.
Yeah.
But you've accepted it there. My point is, if the deck is a cantilever deck, it's exempt, but if it has a couple posts holding it up, it's not exempt.
Yeah.
So that one particular item, I would like to see left in as an exception. And I think,
yep.
John, that kind of gets back to...
I'm going to figure out how to do decking driveways in. Just saying.
Well, I suppose if you really want to cantilever your driveway.
Yeah, cantilever.
You know, architects are clever.
Any other planning commission input on John's suggestion?
Well, yeah, I'm inclined. I pretty much agree with Mike, and I'm wondering if just putting three back in except and crossing out permeable pavement, and I don't know about D, the pervious surfaces of compliance, you know, that the grass modular grid and the open grid decking should qualify. But I'd leave them at 50%. I wouldn't move them up into two to make them, you know, wide open. But
so you're recommending John's suggestion, except not for permeable pavement.
Yeah, and I don't know. Yeah,
D would go away.
I don't know what D is. I don't. What is Stacy or somebody? What's D?
Yeah, we put that one in when we were trying to incorporate stormwater stuff with lot coverage. But then when we looked at it, we're like, there really is no other material, pervious material for driveways other than pervious pavement or pavers. Or, like we said, the open grid decking or the grass modular grid, or not open grid decking, but the grass modular grid. So what we were getting was applicants were saying, oh, well, it says I can use another material, and we're like, there really isn't one. So that was why we wanted to take it out.
Okay, so, then I'll say I want to put three back in and take out A and D. So I want three was just B and C. That's my position.
Well,
any other thoughts from the Planning Commission? Oh, go ahead, Eric.
I think you were about to chime in.
I did. The other reason why we're taking out grass modular grid is because that's another pervious pavement option in the manual that can be used. So we felt that was, again, offering an incentive for something that's required. Isn't it, Jenny? Isn't grass modular grid still in the... It doesn't get used in single-family residential as much because we don't really allow it on individual driveways because the grass doesn't grow.
But aren't you confusing a requirement for stormwater and an incentive for planning coverage? Those are two different things.
Yes, they are.
Two different things.
I think we're combining them, not confusing
them. Well, and frankly, this is what led to some of this discussion in the first place, is what we were finding was people were coming in with, say, a house, and they would get their house approved, and there maybe it was a single family house, so there wasn't any storm review. And then they would come back and say, oh, and we're going to do a pervious driveway. And then it would come over to the stormwater folks, and we would be like, well, wait a minute, this isn't being designed per the stormwater design manual. So sure, it's pervious, you know, the top 2 inches is pervious, but it wasn't being designed with a rock bed, or it was on a super high slope, or, and it was sort of after the fact. So as we couldn't say from a stormwater perspective, you need to design that per the stormwater manual. And so it was like mixing apples and oranges. And so that's why we're suggesting taking, sort of getting away from that and moving maybe more towards, you know, open space and versus pervious and impervious materials in terms of lot coverage. If that makes sense. It was getting too mixed up, you know, between stormwater requirements and lot coverage requirements. We were trying to separate those two by moving more towards there's lot coverage and there's open space, which I understand is a future discussion, right, rather than incentives or exemptions to lot coverage.
Okay.
You know, I'm still trying to understand if somebody came and said we want to make our driveway pavers, if it was a hard surface concrete driveway, you're going to have runoff. The pavers will mitigate that a little bit.
A little bit, but if those pavers aren't designed with, you know, maybe the soils underneath don't perk at all.
Mm-hmm. But how is that different than a solid concrete driveway that was approved?
It's exactly the same, and that's my point, is that if you were doing, if you have very marginal soils, you wanted to use pervious pavers from a stormwater perspective, you would go and you would put a rock bed and do some other things to make sure that the water would get stored and have more time to soak into the soil. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you didn't do that, it would be pretty much the same as a hard surface driveway.
No, I'm tying together what you're thinking about now. So, mm-hmm.
But if it's something that's in compliance with the stormwater design manual adopted, then would that address your issues as far as it actually absorbing the stormwater?
From a stormwater perspective, yes. Yeah. But again, it gets back to sort of this discussion of what is planning looking for in terms of open space
what
versus
open
lot
space?
Coverage.
Got it.
Open space,
separate. Right? Yeah. But your concerns about the stormwater issue that you were just like the impervious surface below that, you know, whatever the grid, that could be addressed if we required that it's consistent with the stormwater design manual. As far as stormwater concern. I understand it's a completely separate issue from open space.
Yeah, and again, we're just trying to separate the two as much as we can.
And Kirkland has a specific detail of how to install pavers.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on the plan. That mm-hmm. detail is on the plan. Mm-hmm. And so it's over rock. It's not over sand because water doesn't go through sand. We all know that. But it's over rock, and there's a specific detail for it. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's move this along. Any other input from the Planning Commission before we make our recommendation? I heard at least Glenn sounds like he's, I think Glenn, you're saying you're okay with at least the, you were talking B and C, but then you're backing off on B or no?
No.
You're good with B as long as it's
C and D.
Meets the...
No, I want...
C and D.
I want B and C left in.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I do
you said.
Want A and D deleted.
Got it. Mike said C. Anybody else? I didn't hear anything from the rest of the commission as far as your kind of...
I don't have strong opinions. I think that it seems like we're having two discussions here about what is open space
exactly.
And what are we trying to do here. And I'm a little hesitant to make decisions on how we're going to regulate open space as part of this process.
Right.
I see C as not as being okay leaving in without really thinking about how. I feel like that's a bit removed from the rest of the discussion about open space. But at any rate, I suppose my preference would be to only leave that in, I guess. I don't want to. My concern is I don't want to go too far down the line about changing how we think about open space or really even.
Yeah,
having that discussion.
Colleen, I see you nodding.
Yeah,
yes.
That's what I'm concerned about is that we're getting all into a big hairball over open space versus lot coverage versus this stormwater, and I don't want to go down that road. And then the clearest one to preserve is C.
I just will add that I think this is an interesting and important discussion, and what we should I would like to see on our work program at some point soon.
Sandeep, you had something?
I had a question, actually. Not being an expert in these materials, one of the things that I worry about with incentives is making sure that the incentives kind of give reasonable opportunity for anyone to make the choice to exercise the incentive. We've talked about how impervious surface or impervious pavement doesn't really meet that criteria because some properties are have access to that incentive and others don't. Is the same thing true for C, that essentially all properties would have, or all homeowners would have the ability to make that choice?
The open grid decking?
Yes.
Seems like anybody could put open grid decking. Yeah.
I was wondering if there's any types of environments where it could not be used.
John, go ahead.
I don't know them.
John can probably respond as well as anyone.
Okay, yeah.
Well, the comment on that is that open grid decking over pervious areas, presumably preferring to a deck like most all of us have on the back of our house. There's very specific building code criteria about even pressure treated joists and its proximity to soil and then the decking material on top of it. It has to be a certain distance away from soil, so that's going to lift these decks up off the ground. So anybody that's trying to design a home that walks right out and wants to come right on Mother Earth and walk straight out without stepping down is not going to work. Their decks are going to be elevated up, and they're going to have to step down upon the ground. So I think from a design standpoint, that limits ambulatory issues and that sort of thing, where you want to design flush homes with no steps.
We're not changing that by this code.
Well, there's the question was on decking. So.
All right. All right. Any other? Let's move on. Let's get on. It sounds like our only concern, the only question is whether to eliminate the 115.90.3 exemptions or not, or at least not eliminate the open grid decking and have that included. So let's get a quick straw poll among us. Moving on, because I want to get a decision on this. John's recommendation is we eliminate it completely.
Rick?
Yeah, yeah.
Can I make a comment?
Sure, Mike.
For clarification, I was suggesting that the open grid decking
goes up under
2B.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. I follow that. So, really, we're looking at what Mike's suggesting, which would be. We include open grid decking as an exception under 2B, or John's suggestion, which would be that we retain all the exemptions under 3 as they exist currently. So by a show of hands, let's get a quick read on that. Who's in favor of Mike's recommendation that we only include the exception for the open grid decking? Okay, Betsy. Who's in favor of John's recommendation that we include all of the exemptions under 3? And
I'm not.
Elsie, you're undecided? Okay, fair enough. So let's, I'm personally kind of could go either way on it. So let's, I would welcome a motion for our recommendation and we'll see where it goes. John, you want to take a stab at it?
I move we recommend the LID proposed amendments with the exemptions. I get the right page here. 115.90.3 being left in.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor that we recommend the amendments to the Kirkland Zoning Code for the stormwater low impact development principles to address the NPDES stormwater permit requirements with the exception of 115.90.3, which would be retained. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, so our recommendation is 4-1 that we do. Now it's to the Planning Commission.
Thank you. I thought somebody was. Oh, any further discussion from the Commission on this issue?
Well, do you two like Mike's
position
or Mike? I'm fine with giving up on B, but do you like Mike's idea or my idea? You want to move it to open grid up to. Or leave it as a 50%.
I'd like to hear from anyone else in the commission. Mr. Singhal.
Yeah, my preference would be if we're, as long as we're moving, removing the other exceptions and keeping it as an exception seems reasonable. So it's a 50% exception as opposed to moving it into the earlier section. It seems more consistent with the principle of minimizing change.
Just to understand, are you saying that it would be an exception but still has to meet the 50% lot coverage requirement, or that they could cover the entire lot with the open grid decking?
No, I'm suggesting keeping it as a 50% exception rather than moving it to a full exception.
I see.
Mr. Miller, you were going to clarify that you wanted as a full exception, is that right?
Yeah, because I think it's the same as the pervious areas below eaves, balconies, and cantilever portions. My point was, if you cantilever a deck, then it's a cantilever portion of the building. It's exempt. You put a couple posts to hold it up. Now it's an exception. You only get 50%. It doesn't make any sense.
So you're saying it would need to be attached to the building?
The deck? Yeah. I'm assuming that's what we're talking about.
Okay.
Deck attached, not...
Okay. Not like a free. I don't know if people do that. Freestanding decks.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it doesn't have to do whether it's attached to the building or not. I'm going to say you're going to say that. I'd rather move cantilevered portions of the building down from two down to three. But I don't care. You know, I'm easy on all of it, whichever one. You know.
Any other? Anyone else want to express any opinion on any of that, or Mr. Miller's proposal, or Mr. Singhal's proposal? And maybe if not, we'll entertain a motion and see where this shakes out. I will say that I agree with Mr. Miller. That's my preference.
Yeah, mine too.
Okay. I would move that we approve CAM 16-02154 with modification that exception 115.93C be moved up to 115.92B.
No,
clarify 90. that it's attached to that any decks are attached to the building. And then delete the remaining paragraph 3.
Staff got that, Paul?
Well, I was waiting for a second.
Okay. You don't mean move it to B, move it to, I don't know, as.
No, move it to B. To B.
Oh, just
to B.
Okay, add it on to the end of that sentence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was there a second?
I'll
second.
Copy of it's attached.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So just the question I'm trying to understand is that, are you saying that it has to be below the eave, balcony, or other cantilever portion?
That's right. It should be a separate bullet point, Mike. It should be F or something. Or
can they do this on the entire lot outside their footprint?
Well, no, because then it would be more than 100% of the lot. I mean,
if you read the exception, that's... Are you covering the entire lot or just below the eaves and the cantilever portion of the balconies?
What, Mike, is what you want to say is should be, say, pervious areas below eaves, balconies. Pervious areas may be below open grid decking, eaves, balconies, and other cantilevered portions of buildings. Isn't that what you mean?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, is Mike's motion as clarified fine, or do we need an amendment? Do we have a?
I think it's clear.
Okay.
Mind, I think.
Clear to me too.
I second.
Okay. And you seconded his motion as clarified too.
Okay.
Okay. Great.
Call the question.
Okay. Any further discussion on Mr. Miller's motion? Okay. Hearing none, I will. All those in favor of Mr. Miller's motion, seconded by Ms.
Aye.
Cullen.
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Pruitt. Okay. Good staff. follow? Oh, do you need any? Okay, great. Thank you.
Eric, if you wouldn't mind, I did get a little lost in there. If you wouldn't kind of end up where we ended up. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I did. So, Paul, do you mind? Seriously, I got a little lost of exactly where they ended up.
Well, the way I understood it, if I understood it correctly, that it only applies to those decks below the E's. Or
No.
Okay,
no.
I'm sorry.
Can I read that again, what I said? Or can I show you what I said? After the area, pervious areas below in 2, add the words open grid decking, and
comma,
then it goes
E's,
on.
Comma. And then E's.
Below E's, pervious areas, below open grid decking, below E's, you know, actually, no, it's below open grid decking, E's, balconies, and other cantilevered portions of buildings. So it's not decks just below those.
Okay, so you
it's
can
open grid.
So then you could cover your entire lot in decking.
Yeah,
right.
It sounds like
there's
not an exemption for decking to me. You're only exempting the pervious area below the open grid decking. But the C is gone then from 3. Right? So open grid decking would not be an exemption.
Number 3 is gone entirely.
Right. So open grid decking is not exempted at all. It's the pervious areas below
open
grid decking.
It's an exception to lot coverage then.
It's an exception to lot coverage.
Yeah. So open grid decking would be an exception.
Oh, yeah, which
coverage.
Could cover the whole property.
Yes.
It's very different from a cantilevered portion of a building,
right.
It seems, which is a unique, you know, that's a limited feature that you see, whereas a deck could cover, it could surround the whole house and cover the whole property. So just to be aware.
Except where there's a wetland or stream buffer. It couldn't
right.
cover that. So
but
we can't really say the whole lot.
But if it's, we also allow them to extend into setbacks, which cantilevered portions of buildings couldn't. So it could be a much, but so that's something we might need to come back when we look at open space and prohibit open grid decking in open space in order, if we're trying to retain 50% of the property as
right.
open space.
Right, yeah, because
that'd be a really big change.
It was 50% under the exemption, but now you're giving
the
whole thing exception. So I think we, probably not what we wanted.
Was that?
It wasn't our recommendation.
But I think the thing that we're trying to do is, again, unknit this hairball, right? If we've got to come back in a follow-on discussion and say this isn't acceptable in open space, then that...
I understand, but in the meantime, people could cover, if you have a 10,000-square-foot lot and 5,000-square-foot building, you have 5,000-square-foot of decking, but you have a 10,000-square-foot coverage.
Open grid.
Over pervious. Actually, you could... Well, wait a minute. Yeah.
Or AstroTurf.
Not by our recommendation, you couldn't. If I could, just as a comment also, the term open grid decking is a pretty old school term, like brick pavers is an old school term. Modular pavers is the correct terminology today, not brick pavers. And open grid decking, there's new technologies now because of polymers that allow a wood deck to have a grid placed on it and then some sort of modular material that is open and porous and drips through, that's not deck boards that we all grew up with. So there's some really cool technology now that allows for a different look and feel of a deck that achieves the same sort of drip through thing that may not meet the old school term of grid decking. So you might want to just look at that when you. It's like saying brick paver. I mean, they're not called brick pavers anymore. They're called modular pavers.
But before we move off of this topic, I sense some apprehension on the commission's maybe. Is there? Perhaps when anybody...
A retraction?
I sense apprehension on the staff's part of raising
well,
the staff raised a good issue.
People look askance for a moment. Before we leave this topic, is there any
I do have to say that my intent was not to provide an out for somebody to be able to
yes.
put a deck over their entire lot. I had in my own mind an idea of a couple hundred square foot deck backs. And if we, I don't even know how we would go about
yes,
unwinding this.
Yeah.
Well,
make we, 50 make a motion to reconsider.
I see no reason not to leave three there with something under it. I mean, if I get the idea of trying to sort of, we get rid of a whole section, but I think it was fine to have something to the section, as I said. I'm not sure I want to go this far, but I could argue stuff under certain portions of the building should be 50% too. So I think the concept of some things falling into the 50% exception is really valid. So I would rather leave, you know, some things, you know, leave that in there. I'd rather discuss whether to move other stuff into it rather than saying, oh, let's try to, you know, get rid of it.
And in fact, there was another clause in there that talks about the exception can not exceed an area equal to 10% of the total lot area.
Yep.
So there is some limitation there how that could be applied.
Yeah.
So if that's intended to keep it somewhat minimum, then perhaps there's a hybrid between what Mike is suggesting and Glenn is talking about. We keep the exception, but then that'd be the one exception you have in there.
Right.
And there's some limitations on the area of the size.
I will admit I have some concern of what we may have made a mistake in just passing that. So,
like a motion to make a motion to reconsider. Is that right?
Any second?
I'll second.
Okay. But discussion on I guess this motion to reopen this and reconsider our prior recommendation. Any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, we will. All those in favor of Mr. Singhal's motion to reconsider our decision.
Aye.
Okay. We'll continue our discussion then on our recommendation. I was hearing some interest from the commission on retaining three, the exemption, perhaps modifying the language to try to accomplish what we were aiming to accomplish without the unintended consequences. Does anybody have a proposal?
How about if I retry it?
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Move that we approve CAM 16-02154 with the changes, but leaving in subparagraph 3 of 115.90, leave in 3C and eliminate A, B, and D, or delete A, B, and D.
Second.
Okay, any discussion on Mr. Miller's motion? Okay, in that case, we'll call for the question. All those in favor of Mr. Miller's motion to essentially, it's our recommendation as before, except we're not moving it up to two. We're fixing our mistake. We're keeping three and just retaining exemption C, but otherwise removing the other exemptions. Okay, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Pruitt. Okay, so is it clear to staff what we just did? Okay. Did not do and did do?
And undid.
Yeah. Okay.
And is that better, just square my hope.
I'm clear.
The only difference you guys left it all in. Right?
That's the difference.
Our recommendation was to leave it all in. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Great. It's our recommendation. Okay. Should we move on? Any administrative reports?
Yes. I think there are some.
We want to do some calendar checking in with you all. The last 2 or 3 months, we've been challenged in trying to get things on the agenda and make sure we can work for these dates. So just to clarify, you know, the October 27th Planning Commission meeting is canceled. We have a workshop on Houghton Everest, and we're inviting everybody to attend. The Planning Commission has perhaps a more of a role, Houghton Community Council, you please come and observe, and City Council may come as well, but I think we have at least 4 or 5 Planning Commission members able to attend that. On November 28th, we have a joint meeting with the Planning Commission Houghton on the Houghton Everest Neighborhood Center, so I think we've got enough Planning Commission members for a quorum, if I recall. November 10th, meeting is canceled for the Planning Commission. Kind of skipping around here. November 15th is when the City Council will be hearing the critical area regulations. So, Eric, will you be able to attend that meeting for presentation?
Yes. November 15th?
That's correct.
Yeah. And just to clarify, November 28th, that is a Monday.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then, again, that would be a kind of a separate two-agenda meeting because Planning Commission and Houghton will meet together, then Planning Commission will leave, and Houghton Community Council will meet on final action on the LID changes. And we can talk about decks. On December 8th, we still have the Planning Commission meeting scheduled for that date. It could be the retreat. We're still working on that. So are you all available for that meeting?
Yes.
For when?
December 8th. Our regular meeting.
Oh, okay.
Right. Is there everybody here available for that meeting? Okay.
Looks like it.
December 15th, we're looking for another joint meeting with the Planning Commission, Houghton Community Council. Is that available?
You offered 12th as an alternative, and I would strongly recommend 12th because it just so happens that on the 15th, the Seahawks are hosting the Rams for Thursday night football.
Unfortunately.
and I have season tickets.
We don't have a room for the 12th.
I'm unavailable on the 12th. I have another meeting.
You have no room in the anywhere that we could meet?
The City Council Chambers is not available. We can check on another room, but it won't be we won't be able to broadcast, though, and record as I think the Houghton room will be under construction.
The room down?
Peter Kirk room will be under construction.
Oh. So. Okay. What are we covering for that meeting?
That's the Houghton Everest Neighborhood Center.
Oh, crap.
We could try to find another date, maybe on the 14th or something.
That would certainly be desirable.
Let's see. Park Board meets and transportation. I think Park Board meets on the 14th. So.
13th?
City Council meeting.
Bump them. The following week?
No.
No way?
Right.
No.
Previous? Well, what about the 8th?
Well, that's another possibility.
Why don't we just do it the 8th?
If we talk it fast.
We'll have to check with our team on that one because the consultants are on a schedule and that's possible, but we'll have to check with them to see if that can work. How about the rest of the community council? 8th or?
Is 8th worth for you guys?
What? What's the date?
December 8th.
December 8th?
Yeah. Thursday, December 8th. Planning Commission's meeting anyway. We'd be just meeting with them.
What if we, Paul, could you, and Rick, you owe me for this. Could you, I know this staff consideration, can you kind of like swap the 8th and the 15th agendas around?
That's what we would do.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, maybe instead of
if it'll work with our schedule for the consultants and the team.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. We will have just met with them the week before, though.
No.
No.
On the 28th?
No, what we're saying is we would swap so that the joint meeting would be on the 8th and then they would meet on the 15th.
Well, yeah, but you're saying. Well,
we meet on the 28th for the Houghton Neighborhood Center.
Right.
And then on the 8th. For the Houghton Neighborhood Center,
right?
That's what, 2 weeks apart.
That could be tight. That could be tight to turn it around because I think we're coming back with scenarios and options for your consideration. We want to make sure we have the right product to bring back. Let's maybe try for the 14th if we find a room, or the 12th if we can find a room.
Okay.
How's everybody else feel about those two dates?
I'm not available on the 12th, 13th,
changing it to the 14th? Is that what
no, he's asking availability on the 12th or the 14th.
I can try to move my other commitment, but I'm not available on the 12th.
Okay, the 12th.
Right now, I'm not.
So, 14th possibly.
I'm available. I don't, it's a Wednesday, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a park board. Couldn't you have the park board in a smaller meeting room? And
have Colleen is not available on the 14th.
I'm sorry.
I'm not available on either the 12th or the 14th, unfortunately.
I'm sorry, Sandeep?
I'm not available on either the 12th or the 14th.
Okay.
And I'm not available on the 14th.
So I think we've got a little bit of a dilemma here, Rick.
Talk about the 19th.
Let me see if we can move the Seahawks game.
19th?
That's a design review board meeting. We have to find another room.
For them?
No. I think it might be under construction or being remodeled at that point. But the 19th is another possibility if we can find another room.
Who can do the night?
I won't commit to that one myself. I don't know. I won't know. I'll just say no for me. But go ahead and have it if it's for everyone else.
Mondays are always likely for me because it's the same night as my board meeting at work. But usually it'll be done by the time we get here. But if it's not, that's where it'll be.
So it sounds like I'm
available on the 19th.
Okay.
Sounds like that works.
But
everybody here on our group, 19th work for all of us, Monday the 19th?
It's no.
You can't make it, Elsie?
Monday night?
Monday the 19th.
Of December.
Yeah, I probably can do it.
Good. Okay.
It's my son's birthday and... I have a doctor's appointment, but I think we can do that during the day.
See if you can do that.
Right. If not, we'll have to go back to the 15th.
Okay, the 19th.
That gives them a few extra days for the consultants.
Precedence over the 8th, the 12th, and the 14th, right? Well, my pen's still here. What are we doing?
Everything depends on what's available.
I think the 12th and the 14th are out, if I hear enough people saying that. So we're looking at the 15th.
We've got the 8th, 15th, or the 19th, maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
It's tough.
And then on January 26th, I'm sorry, January 26th, yeah, that's another, that'll be actually a joint hearing on the Houghton Everest Center.
Well, that's fast.
And then we would cancel the January 23rd Houghton Community Council meeting, and then you can take action on the final CFP table.
Good.
That night.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Works.
Does that work on the 26th for Brian, Betsy, Elsie?
As far as I know.
So January we'd have the 23rd and the 26th?
No, we'd be...
We cancel the 23rd.
We'd be canceling the 23rd, moving it to the 26th. Everybody's good with it?
Yeah.
All right, good.
Thank you all.
Make the 19th work.
Can I point out on this calendar, which you mailed out, is Eric's name? November is wrong.
See how many times that can get changed.
Oh, yeah, I actually was going to bring that up too. The,
November 17th is.
So we're not having the meeting on the 17th of November, correct? That's all that ended up on this one that was in our packet. I think it was proposed at one point.
Right, it was.
Mm-hmm. We are not going forward with
that's
that.
That's correct, or okay. November 10th.
Okay.
November.
Okay.
November 10th or 17th is not.
Are we meeting on the 19th of December?
We're not sure yet.
Okay.
November 28th.
Turn off your mics so you guys.
And the 28th.
Yeah, thank you.
Paul, thank you for doing this.
Paul, do you need to say anything about the city council actions on sign regs and marijuana regs?
Yeah, that was really for the Planning Commission, because you'll be taking action later tonight on both those topics, but the City Council approved the sign regulations as pretty much recommended by the Planning Commission. And then on the marijuana regulations, they agreed with the Houghton Community Council to exempt the Community Council from the regulations for reducing the buffer, but they did go with the 100-foot buffer requirement.
All right.
From daycare centers, I think.
Yeah.
Chair Eric was there.
Right. The council had a lot of ideas on the sign regulations for our next phase, too, in particular, Councilmember Asher.
That's correct.
Yes, it's his thing.
Hobby horse. Okay, great.
All right.
No one is left in the audience to give comments. So I guess,
meeting adjourned.
There we are. Thank you.
We're going to have a 5-minute break for our council, and then we got to come back and finish our business.
I vote we don't have a 5-minute break, that we just get with it so we can go home.
5-minute break. That's it. Unless you don't.
I don't think we need one. Let's just
do this.
This is
2 minutes for Brian.
Oh, okay. Let's do this.
Give me 1 minute.
Okay. 2 minutes for Brian.
Oh, okay.